Colin. I am back again with Dom, who is finally back in England. How does it feel to be back home, Dom?
It feels interesting. So if I'm sounding more despondent than usual, that might be why. But after being away for so long, it feels weird not only being back here, but just podcasting in this environment, because there's no like Airbnb landlords yelling at me to keep it down, no weird acoustics I have to work around, no trying to keep it quiet at 2 o'clock in the morning somehow. So yeah, it feels weird to be back, but also good to be back doing this with you.
Yeah, definitely feels great to have you back in England so that we don't have to work around any of those Airbnb restrictions that we were dealing with before. Although it was great getting to see you when you were here in America. And I hope that you did, now that you're back in England, have had some time to adjust again. I hope you did enjoy your stay. And it was a positive memory in retrospect.
Oh, absolutely. And I always find that after I'm away from home for a long time, when I get back, I'm always just in this kind of funk for a few weeks that it takes me a while to get out from. So, but maybe that's not happening this time because I'm leaving the country again in like less than a week. So that's going to be fun. But yeah, it's good to be here. And I don't know. It's just like thinking back on like the whole 3 week experience, it was a ton of fun. It was it was so great to meet so many of you. And it's just making me sad now that I know I'm not going to get to do that again for a long time, probably. So I'm going to savor that memory for a long time.
Well, do you want to fill us in on where you're going in a week? I do know. I just forgot momentarily, but you don't have to.
Not especially.
Okay.
But yeah, it's, I don't know, any excuse to get out of England, basically, I will happily leap at that chance. Although it is worth noting, as we record this on late on a Sunday night, that somehow, while we were in the same time zone, that didn't help our recording scheduling problems one bit. So I think that's going to be a permanent fixture moving forward, even if I somehow manage to escape this country permanently.
I really feel like it's much easier when you're in England and in a different time zone, frankly. But maybe that's just from my perspective, where it is literally 2 o'clock in the morning for you right now.
Right. Maybe my sleep cycle is just so messed up anyway that it helps to be 5 hours ahead. I don't know.
Yeah. All right. Well, Dom, we are back to break down this week episode 5. That's right. Episode 5. As many of you have surely heard, Rob Cesternino declared this week Survivor Daylight Saving Time. And we are all skipping ahead forward to episode 5. We were people who initially, when this whole what episode are we on controversy went down, I definitely was an adamant defender of erring on the lower side because I thought something like this might happen. I thought we might get some kind of grand statement of this is officially episode X. And I thought that was basically a 50-50 shot of whether they would go low or high. So I thought, of course, you have to err on the side of going low, because otherwise there would be a lot of people left right now with a back-to-back episode 4s, for instance. So we are officially, though, observing hashtag Survivor DST. We are officially on episode 5. Dom, any hot takes on episode numbers? Are you willing to conform to this?
Well, so all of that makes sense. However, it does irk me a bit that episode 4 just never exists. And if anyone asks, that's going to be the official consensus now. It just never happened. And there's going to be some kind of like cover up, I guess. But I don't know. Can't we just go like week 1, week 2, week 3? It feels like that solves every conceivable problem.
Right. That's what we did back in the glory days, Dom, when we were podcasting about Big Brother every summer. I always was an advocate for week X. That's definitely the way to do it, just with all the double rounds and triple evictions and whatnot that they're throwing at these kids these days. I guess that is doable with Survivor, but I think we've always called it episode whatever, and we've just run into these kind of situations from time to time.
Yeah, I feel like it had to be Rob leading the way on this, because if we had unilaterally declared, okay, this is now going to be episode 5, and this is the new scheme moving forward, and then Rob was like, actually, no, it isn't, and just carried on with episode 4. I feel like we would have had to back down and go away with our tails between our legs.
Yeah. I wonder what's going to happen. I feel like we do know that we're getting another 2-hour episode later this season. I guess we call that episode whatever it'll be, episode like 9 plus 10 or whatever. Is that gonna, or are we gonna have the same issue later on?
But so after week 3 was this hashtag game changer. I don't know what the format's gonna be anymore, and I know I'm sure someone can like work backwards and deduce what the schedule has to be. But yeah, maybe that's gonna be a double boot episode. Maybe it's like one boot with some weird twist where somehow they can stretch out into 2 hours. Who really knows at this point, honestly?
Well, I feel like it was Mike Bloom. I'm going to be the one who gives credit for this. I feel like he told me that I think it was April 19th, and I just looked, and that is a Wednesday, so it would check out. I feel like he said that that is going to be a 2-hour episode, and I imagine with two boots. So I guess I'm guessing we'll just all be on the same page. Hopefully, entering that episode, we can decide ahead of time what to be calling those 2 hours.
So the question for me about that is that just going to be two episodes back to back, or is it going to be two episodes that, knowing that those are going to be linked together, that's how it's been edited, and it actually is like continuous in some way? Because I know there was one example in the past where there was one episode that finished like to be continued or something. And so like you can imagine, let's say if in Philippines, if they'd done this, where like Malcolm and Denise go down to two and then they get sent to their new tribes, like that could have been a 2-hour thing. Or there are lots of these episode pairs which, if you like, staple them together and then move a few things around, that could be a proper two-hour episode. At the same time, there are lots of episodes which there's basically no link whatsoever, and there's no amount of like hatchet job editing you could do to make it seem like a continuous thing. So that's going to be fun to see.
Right. I don't think this is an Australian Survivor situation, Dom, where we're going to get like 4.5 hours of content between every boot, and then half of them aren't going to even count in the end. I think this is going to be kind of like the premiere, where it is two different boots that are strung together, and we will definitely go straight from Tribal Council back to the camp. They will not be foolish enough to put a commercial break in between there and let people tune out, thinking that that's the end of Survivor for the week. So right. I think it's going to blend together as if it's one just giant 2-hour episode with two boots.
In retrospect, it's kind of amazing that Australian Survivor got us to the point where we were thinking, there is too much Survivor. Please give us less of this and make it, you know. It's anyway, those dark days are in the past now, and we can move forward.
It didn't even take long. It was like episode 11 before I was like, oh man, I am really getting full on Australia. And I loved the early episodes. I was along with the people saying, oh my God, this is better than US Survivor, or at least on par. Right. And very quickly, it was like, you know what it was like? And this is probably going to be lost on you. It was like the NBC show Heroes that, for my money, had like the strongest like first 10 episodes like to that point that I'd really like seen even in my life, and then I was ready to quit by episode 15, and I literally did quit by like before the end of the first season.
It feels like that's the fate of so many TV shows though, that like that they exist for long enough for all of their hardcore fans to start hating it by the end, and it's so many of them would be so much better regarded now if they just cut it quits like two seasons earlier.
Right, that is a very nice segue, Dom, as we, I think, well, let's start transitioning into talking about this episode, as we are going to lose our boy JT here, who finally lived long enough to see himself become the villain here.
Yeah, for anyone concerned out there, this is not just going to be mourning JT for the next hour and a half, or however long this ends up lasting for. We do actually have some serious bones to pick with his decisions here and his whole story arc this season, and there's a lot to say, certainly. But yeah, it's weird after all of our preseason like hype and debate about JT, and after I just spent all of my life savings on him in our draft, to see him just walk out the door in, I'm going to call it week 4 to kind of really diminish him even further, but episode 5 if you prefer.
Yeah, I was just looking back over, because it had been a long time since I'd just checked it, our auction draft that we did before the season, and if I'm looking at this correctly, it appears to me that JT was the most expensive item that went up for bids. We had you bought JT for $16.50. The next highest was Suri for $15, who you also purchased.
Yeah, not looking great. I also bought Aubrey for $14, which I could certainly wish I could mulligan at this point. I think Koss maybe got hardest hit with Malcolm, like his one like big splashy pick going out in outrageous circumstances last week. But looking at the teams now, I'm not sure who even has a good team. Like who's even happy about the players left on the board?
Right, Charity is who's happy about like Brad Culpepper. Yes. None of us wanted to draft Brad Culpepper, and we decided in June that if Brad miraculously wins this season, we'll donate the entire $108.50 to charity. I think that is who has the best looking team so far right now.
Yeah, I think among the $53 that I somehow spent on this, Sarah at $1.50 is somehow my best value pick left on the board, which is a truly terrifying thought.
Yeah, all right. Well, let's get into to all of this, but definitely interesting for sure to see all of these people that were such big ticket items back in June. Now, you know, half of them are off. They're like Tony, I spent $11.50 on. You referenced Malcolm, went for $12.50. We've already lost over $50 out of the prize pool in a month of episodes.
It's like half the money is already gone. So it's going to be towards the end. It's like my $1.5 pick versus your $2 pick versus Coz, who bought like Ty for $1 and he's going to be there at the final five. And that's going to be his one shining hope left at the end.
Yeah. All right. Well, enough about our personal draft. Let's get into this episode. Last week, we, of course, had all of that craziness go down with the double vote. And now the blue team is back. You know, the two tribes going to tribal council. Now the blue team is back and all eyes are on JT. And he is denying any wrongdoing other than telling them that, you know, I told Culpepper he was safe. But I guess however they did it, they inferred it from me. What did you think of JT here? Is there any merit in coming clean and saying, oh, my God, I screwed up. I really have to just be truthful with you guys now. Or does he have to stick with the lie at this point?
Well, it depends on how aware JT is that everyone is seeing through him. Because at the point where like everyone suspects you of having done something wrong, I think you do just have to come clean and say, okay, yeah, I fucked up. And you don't have to say, oh, yeah, sorry, Sandra, I was trying to target you. But you at least like you tell some small lie that you can maybe spin in a way that sounds decent, as opposed to maintaining this ridiculous lie that no one even believes and only serves to make you look even worse.
Yeah, I think he tried to do that. If I'm interpreting what he said correctly,
yeah.
His excuse to them was, I told Culpepper he was safe, but I said, you all aren't safe, like, and hinted, like, strongly that it was him and Sierra might not both be safe. Like, I think he did try to play it off. Even more ownership than, you know, just telling Culpepper he was that he personally was safe. Like, I think he did kind of almost give them what they want, but clearly not well enough. And I think you're right that it seems like they were all so quick to see through it anyway, that when the entire other tribe does know exactly how that went down and you went over to tell them, hey, the votes are going on Sierra, I think that is something that JT probably should have a little more interest in just clearing up and getting out of the way right now and just taking his medicine.
The missing ingredient for me is, so JT tells them, yeah, I told Brad he was safe, but why would he do that? So if it's, I told Brad he was safe as like a form of misdirection so that they would think it was someone else, but actually we were all going for Brad, then okay, maybe that would make sense. But they weren't going for Brad, and so all that really did was take one person who maybe could be a target out of the equation. So now now when Ty is choosing who to play his idol on, it's one out of four people instead of one out of five people, let's say.
Well, when Haley made that comment at Tribal Council about, I think this is a good time to target a big physical threat, Sandra was really, really eager to pull in every person of the six and say, oh, she wants Brad Culpepper out, she wants Brad Culpepper out. So that at least could be a feasible lie, is if JT could claim, oh, I thought Brad might hear his name getting thrown out there a lot, because it genuinely was, and then he would maybe be fearful about that. That at least is somewhat legitimate. But no, I think you're
right. But
yeah, go ahead.
But when you don't end up voting for Brad, right, then surely that's what you want, right? Like if JT's trying to sell himself as part of this group and he was part of the plan, but he just made his innocent mistake, then surely that would be a great thing, right? If Brad gets paranoid, and maybe if he's the one telling Ty where to use the idol, then he's just going to beg for it himself. So that's, and I'm sure these discussions were had, but it's like, I don't know what JT thinks the others thought of him, because this is the curious thing about JT's whole like rise and fall, and it's unclear how big the rise even was this season. So a few weeks ago he swaps onto this tribe where he's down 5-1 and he instantly recognizes, okay, I'm in this terrible situation, I have to strand my entire tribe out at sea so that I can look for the idol. That's how desperate this is for me. And then we see him this episode too, saying like, I'm the next to go, I have to look for the idol, and sure enough he finds it. But then somewhere between then and him making this terrible blunder at the previous tribal where everyone now suspects him of having done something wrong, which only adds fuel to that fire, somehow between all of that and this tribal in this episode, he somehow became convinced that he was safe and that, you know, he was part of the group again, and everyone was just going along and targeting Michaela because of, if they just found her annoying or something. So I'm just at a loss to know like what conversations were had in the interim to make JT feel like he was safe, and like specifically what was Sandra doing to make him feel like he was so safe.
Right. I have an ongoing theory, and I haven't checked out, I've just been busy this week and haven't seen a ton of the exit press. It seemed to me, like from watching the episode, like Michaela was even playing up that she almost knew she was going home. Like they were lulling him into a super false sense of security. So, he, you know, if he had an idol, he would consider not playing it. Like, one of Sandra's answers at Tribal Council really stood out to me that solidified that kind of in my mind, where she gave some answer that was slightly critical of JT, but then was very quick to say, but, you know, there are other things that we need to factor in, like physical strength in these challenges and who's being helpful around Cam, et cetera. Like, I really think they gave him the hard sell on, you have nothing to worry about. Michaela's a huge problem. And Michaela played it up big time that she was going to be obviously the one who left.
And with Sandra's reputation for this bluntness and honesty, I feel like that works a lot better than trying to say, oh, no, everything is fine. We have no problem with JT whatsoever. Because if you're hearing that from Sandra, that starts to sound suspicious now. Because, like, surely Sandra, of all people, is going to have a problem with me. And if she does, then she's going to voice that. And so if she's trying to make it sound like everything is lovey-dovey, then, yeah, JT, that's almost more suspicious for JT than if she says that, yeah, I actually did have a problem with what he did, but we have bigger things to worry about.
Yeah, I mean, I was wondering, you know, if they weren't giving him this kind of treatment and making him really feel comfortable, it seems to me like he could have gotten to the point just seeing how willing JT has historically been, you know, very notably at this last night's Tribal Council, to do these big dynamic things within the game. I could see him, if he was getting the vibe that, okay, these people just don't believe me, I could see him coming clean and saying, look, here's what I did. You're right. I told them exactly the votes are going on Sierra because I wanted them to idle out Sandra. That is what I want to see happen. I want Sandra to go next. Aubrey is cool with me, and really put the pressure on Jeff Varner. Like, who would you rather be deep in this game with? Me and Aubrey, who are always going to be bigger targets than you, or Sandra and Michaela? And we're going to be in much better shape to avoid challenges with me and Aubrey as well. Avoid, you know, going to Tribal Council.
But honestly, I think Varner's answer most of the time is going to be, I'm going to go with Sandra and Michaela. And that's what we saw. But I think even if they put the hard sell on him and put it in such explicit terms, that would almost tip him over the edge to go with them instead. Because, like, they would see just how hard JT is playing. And JT actually, in his exit press, you said you didn't get a chance to read it, but it was quite revealing, actually. So one of the things he said was, when he felt he was in danger, his pitch to the rest of his tribe for why they should keep him was basically, I have all of these great connections over on Mana from the old Nuku tribe. And so when we get to emerge, like, we're going to need people to come in to us, and I can draw those people in, or at least I can go to them and get some kind of arrangement where you guys can get your foot in the door. And you can see why JT thought that might sound appealing. But at the same time, like, Sandra hearing that is not going to think, oh, great, I get to be eighth or ninth with Brad Culpepper's crew on the other side in 10 days. Like, she's going to want to do her own thing, and she's not going to be enticed by the idea of just being dragged along for the ride and being told what to do. Like, she, however much she wants to say that, she, you know, as long as it's not her, she doesn't care. She does care to some extent, and she wants to at least feel like she has some agency and some control over what's going on, and she doesn't want to feel like she's second fiddle to anyone else, not least people like Brad Culpepper. So I don't know how good an argument that was for JT. I feel like JT's and maybe it's just so obvious that he has to say that, because if he tries to say, oh, I'm not close with Brad, I'm not close with anyone else, no one's even going to believe that. So maybe he's logged into it. But it feels like that's only confirming this idea that JT is this massive threat. He's playing all sides. He has his foot in every, you know, he has his fingers in every pie. And we just need to get him out right now before he can reconnect with those people and cause some real damage.
Right. It does almost come across like Terry Dietz back famously in Exile Island to Ceree, saying, like, come with us and you can be, you know, you'll have the majority, you got nothing to worry about for like the next 4 weeks or whatever his pitch was. Like, why would I hide? Like, I'm the one with leverage here. You're the ones who should be pleading with me. It really does seem like JT is only making it more clear that, like, his number one priority is obviously the Nuku people. But it does seem to me like there's almost nothing he can do about that at this point, unless he's going to give them the sell of, like, I had, you know, issues with people and they only kept, you know, we didn't have to go to a vote and that's why I stayed safe. Like, I don't think that's really within JT's range as a Survivor player to just make up a total lie about and say he was completely on the outs or something like that.
Yeah, to jump forward a bit, I think the final verdict on JT is going to be, yeah, he got unlucky by being put into this position where there were so many tough things that he had to overcome. But at the same time, the attempts that he made to overcome those were pretty clumsy and could have been done a lot better.
I would agree that there were several spots that could have, had they been played slightly differently, could have changed things for JT. We'll definitely
just a little bit, yeah,
slightly. We'll get to all of them. And one thing that I wanted to point out, and I guess we'll get into JT finding the idol quickly, because I have a quick thing I want to say about that. But briefly, there's a shot of JT as he's giving the confessional about, okay, now I need, you know, it seems like after last night, my back might be up against the wall. I need to go find this idol. And as he's giving this confessional, the B-roll that's playing under the voiceover is him pouring himself some coffee, Dom. And this is the kind of thing that I was talking about last week with Malcolm, that they would include, like, there would be no indication that it would mean bad news for him right now the first time you saw it. And one of the ones that I recalled from last week with Malcolm was when Jeff announced, like, the twist of two tribes are going to tribal council. It was Malcolm they show saying, that's kind of a big butt, or whatever the line was. It's things like that. And I really appreciate that kind of stuff from the editors. Like, I really think it's great when they include stuff purely for rewatch purposes.
Right, because that's the kind of thing which literally zero people are going to pick up on the first time. Like, if you ask
Sandra
people at the
end
of the episode,
she'll know what's coming.
Oh, of course. But like, if you ask like average person who goes on the Survivor Facebook fan page at the end of the episode, oh, did you catch the JT coffee thing? Like, literally zero people, and that's not even a shot at them. It's just that's not the kind of thing which would even register with you unless you have a specific reason to think that it would. So, like, if you've, I don't know, read spoilers and you've learned that there's going to be some like coffee gate later on, then maybe that's, you're going to pick up on that. But otherwise, like, yeah, I like that they throw these bones in there for the people who are big enough fans of the show that they would be watching it a second time. Like, yeah. For as much as we criticize the general like editing philosophy or whatever, it's nice that they put that stuff in there.
Well, I would say as much as we have criticized the general editing philosophy, but at least for me, I am at the point after now Malcolm leaving, after being such a compelling winner candidate early on, I still have one person that I think is a lock to go deep, but that's not because of the edit. That's because of it's Michaela, obviously, for all the reasons that I've talked through in previous podcasts. I really don't think, though, after we saw what happened to Malcolm, that I would be comfortable saying there is anyone else that I think is 100% to be there, even as deep as Final Seven. I don't think there is anyone else who is a lock to be in there.
Well, just to take issue with the first part of that, I think Malcolm being a compelling winner candidate, I think that's just who Malcolm is and the way that he presents himself and the way that he's always going to come across on the show. So, like, for as long as Malcolm is there, he is going to be a compelling winning candidate. So the way he was in Philippines and the way he was, to some extent, as well in Caramoran, although I think it was pretty clear that he was not going to be there for the long term there. But I think that's just who Malcolm is. And as opposed to some people who can just be written out of the show, Malcolm is always going to get that kind of treatment regardless of what's going on. So I think it's a bit too charitable to say, oh, they gave Malcolm this great edit, even though they knew he was going to get cut down in these weird circumstances.
I would have said the same thing entering the season about Aubrey, but it seems like they're not giving Aubrey that kind of big edit that they gave, you know, big conceivable number one winner candidate they gave Malcolm for the first few episodes, even knowing how much more brutal that was going to make his elimination for the average, like, CBS casual viewer.
That's fair, and I'm sure there's a whole nother discussion to be had on what the differences are between the two examples, but I think, like, Malcolm, they know has stood the test of time, right? Like, he's from about 4 or 5 years ago now, and you still have people every single season that Malcolm isn't on the Facebook fan page, on other places, asking when Malcolm is coming back. Whereas they might think that Aubrey's appeal was more based on recency bias or something. I don't know.
All right. I mean, I definitely do see what you're saying. Like, Malcolm is someone who is, regardless of how he does, probably going to come across quite well on the show. He's not going to be someone out there blundering and making all these social faux pas or whatever, where they're going to be able to even paint him negatively, even if they wanted to, I would imagine.
I would be intrigued to see if there actually was a noticeable decrease in the number of people watching the show this week just because Malcolm is gone. Like, that would not shock me in the slightest.
It wouldn't. I mean, I think this time of season, it is standard, though, to get a kind of a decline in ratings. This early middle part of the season, I think, is probably the least generally exciting part for the casual audience.
Yeah, it is heavily overdetermined, but at the same time, like, I imagine all the people who say, I'm going to quit watching the show now that Malcolm's gone, this time I think they could actually do it, and that's maybe a scary thought for future seasons.
Well, we can at least calm down until Ozzy is eliminated too, can't we? Do we at least still have Ozzy in there for us?
Yeah, for the sake of science, Ozzy needs to go soon, and then we can conduct like a proper double-blind trial or whatever to see the truth.
Well, I was wondering, if to go back to that group of people that they brought out for the season 33 finale, all the people that were coming up on the Game Changers, and we were like, oh, now that Malcolm's been eliminated, he wasn't one of the people, so the cursed photo is gone. I could see it being the case that both Malcolm and JT would say no to going back and being on the season 33 finale after an early exit, so it does still seem conceivable that those are just the first seven people who said yes, and we could see Ozzy leaving very soon.
Right, it's not like JT is going to get on a flight from Alabama or whatever to somewhere where he literally knows nobody to partake in all of this again.
Right, exactly. I could easily see Malcolm not really want. I mean, I don't know. Obviously, I still think it is a stretch to think that those seven people are in any way going to be anything we could take like educated guesses at, that they would give Reddit any outs to pick up on anything from that group of people.
This is the perfect Long Kong. So they do this now where it obviously doesn't apply to make us think, okay, clearly there's no connection there. And then 10 seasons down the line, when they do this again, it's actually going to come true. And we're going to be thinking, well, no, clearly they wouldn't do that. I mean, look at when they did this before. We have all this historical precedent to base this off. And it's actually just going to be like the first seven people who just like wheeled out onto the stage.
No, I think that is when we will know that the editors are 100% toying with us, is when the bug freak out is a fake, that the person who freaks out over having a bug on them ends up actually winning the season. That has been the curse since the beginning of time.
You need to explain this though, then, because it's going to sound like this esoteric in-joke to so many people.
Well, this is something I learned from you that I'd never heard before we started doing this podcast, and you please correct whatever I'm getting wrong here. But from what I've gathered, there has been a really long-running kind of like in-joke with the editors where they'll include really short clips of people having a bug land on them, and it is always like the kiss of death. Like, that person has never ended up winning, and there are plenty of memorable examples. Like Garrett at the tribal council that he got eliminated at in Cagayan, and earlier this season Sandra had a bug fly into her hair. So like, I think maybe we'll see this is the time where they showed that clip of Sandra and Michaela freaking out about the bug. Like, that kind of stuff is included a lot of the time, and they never go on to win.
And one of the seasons we covered, I think it was Philippines with Scooping, in that challenge where like they had to balance the balls on that disc, and then there was a fly that came and landed on it, and everyone was like, the 10 people in the world who knew about this weird crazy theory, like, freaking out, like, oh my god, this means that Scooping can't win. And half those people were spoiled thinking that Scooping was going to win anyway, so that made it a lot more fun.
Well, isn't this because I don't venture onto Edgic or Survivor Sucks at all ever in my entire life. I found this out from you. I think that is exactly right. During Philippines, it was like well into when we'd started podcasting. Is this only like a very small I thought this was very well known among the people who are into that kind of thing.
So I think it was one of those things that was brought up initially as a joke, like anyone who wears blue trousers in the marooning has never gone on to win the season. And then people realize that actually this correlation is pretty strong over time, and it keeps being validated every single season. And so now it's like a quasi-legit theory that still is probably complete horseshit, but still, it's fun to think about that this actually could be like the clue to deciphering the whole season.
Right. I mean, I feel like it's still, we would have definitely noticed any case past Philippines where it didn't apply, and it seems like ever since then it has continued to hold up. So I don't know. I think we've already spent a long time talking about things other than what goes on in this episode, Tom. Sorry, go ahead.
One of the main pieces of feedback that I got at the live Noradors was, love the show, but spend a little bit less time on the editing. And so we've responded to that by spending 15 minutes on this bizarre fly theory that even the people who care so much about the editing that they go on Edric don't even know or care about.
Yeah. All right. Let's get into JT, and this is what I wanted to bring up 10 minutes ago, finding this idol here, because he finds a clue that is exactly the same as Ty's was, where he gets these coordinates. It's between, you know, where X marks the spot between these trees. And I had a lot of people, after the semi-rant that I went on the previous week about what bullshit it was that Troy Zan's idol was in a challenge while still in Three Tribes, Ty's idol was at camp. I had a lot of people tweet at me some stuff from Jeff Probst, who I'm not even clear on when he said it, but apparently he made it clear that each idol would be entered into the game differently so that no one would have an advantage or anything. Frankly, I avoid as much of the Jeff Probst content as I possibly can. I have zero faith in Jeff Probst if I don't know that it was definitely written way before he knew the results. So I had a lot of that tweeted at me, and I was like, okay, that's totally fine. I will buy that, whatever. But now we get JT getting the identical clue to Ty. Like, Ty, as far as the viewer knows, just found this idol the previous episode. This is a new round, and now JT is getting this same idol. What's going on? To me, it seems like one of two things is going on. And the more likely of the two, I think, is that JT did this last episode, and they just didn't show it. And I would further suspect that means he also didn't bring the idol to the previous tribal council. Like, it seems like that would have been a storyline if it had been remotely in play.
So based on the exit press, that doesn't seem to be the case.
Okay.
I imagine it would have come up if that was true.
So what's the scoop then? Yeah, why is he getting this exact same idol?
So I had also heard that thing about the idols are going to be found in different ways over the course of the season. What I thought that meant was we'd have one that was like what Troy had to do, and then one that was maybe some other thing that we'd never seen before or some other inventive idea. What I didn't think was going to happen was we'd have they would bring back the idol at the challenge for one instance of that, and then everything else would just be a completely bog standard just finding it in a camp like we've seen hundreds of times before. Like, this feels so uninspiring to me. Like, as someone who was on Team JT until about 20 minutes into this episode, despite everything else that had happened previously, even I was not really happy with the way this happened, because it's like, well, it just feels so effortless and so lifeless. Like, why am I meant to get excited about this?
Right, and we go on to see later that Ty, he doesn't go idol hunting for it right now, but he finds the clue for yet another idol, and it looks like it's basically just a map to where he can find yet another idol at camp.
Because what I thought initially was, Ty reads out the clue, and it's, you're going to pour water over this insignia or something, and it's going to mark the way. Well, what I thought that meant was, that's going to be a reference to the challenge, where it's going to be some, water pouring thing, and, there's going to be one spot in the challenge where, you have to look out for this and go and do that. And then we get to the challenge, and there's just nothing like that whatsoever. So, yeah, I thought this was a fun idea at first, but it's quickly regressed into just doing what they wanted to do anyway. So
right.
Yeah,
it seems like they're going with whatever is convenient and whatever they can would work well for that time frame within TV. And the thing to me is, if Ty's idol does end up being something, it seems like he has to pour water over something, some wooden surface at camp, to reveal. They then immediately cut to him by the water well, which is covered in wood. It seems like it is going to be the easiest thing in the world to just go to the water well by himself and just get it. If it is something where it's like on the top of their shelter and he has to be super inconspicuous about like pouring water for no reason in the middle of camp, that I would totally be on board with. And that I would say is a new way of inserting the idol that I would be totally cool with. But it really looks like it's just going to be at the water well, which you can easily have an so it's like literally the best place you can ask for it if you're one of the players, is somewhere you could obviously go by yourself.
Right. If it was in camp, it would at least have a sense of danger to it. Like, maybe someone's going to see what I'm doing and come and ask me about it. As you say, though, at the water well is literally the perfect location where you can just go off by yourself with no one disturbing you. It's like, I could understand almost if they wanted to take this idol off in the sense of just not doing anything crazy with it, but don't make it as easy as possible for the person who's trying to find it. That just seems so pointless to me.
Right. I mean, it's like, Ty, you will, whenever the next time you show up to Tribal Council, it will be in Jeff Probst's pocket. You just have to go up and ask him for it. Like, that would even be much harder. I would much rather get the water
idol.
No question.
Yeah.
Like,
I would love that. That would add some legit drama to Tribal Council. This is just, like, you know there's going to be a scene in one or two episodes' time of, okay, we've got 40 seconds to spare, so here's Ty going off into the woods, and of course, because you're showing us this, he's going to find it, so like you're going to have the music in the background, you're going to have Ty looking exuberant, but beyond that, it's just, like, we all know this is coming, so just get it over with and get it out of the way so we can move on to something more entertaining.
Well, do we all know that it's coming? Like, to me, I know I've already speculated once about them possibly showing JT's idol out of order, which you immediately shot down, and I felt like a total fool. It seems like if they wanted to, they could easily show us Ty finding the clue in conjunction with whenever he finds that idol next week. So to me, it seems like maybe he's going to know that idol's out there and not find it.
So that what you mentioned when the camera shot lingered on the well, I thought that was meant to signify, oh, Ty overlooked the obvious place where it was going to be, and therefore he's not going to find it. So maybe that's what's going to happen.
Okay.
I don't know.
Yeah, maybe that is right. But to me, it seemed like part one of a two-part series that they just had 30 seconds in each episode free to show us for whatever reason, of Ty finding a new idol. That would be my guess as things stand right now. But going forward, I would just love it if we could get some kind of consistency with the idol or some degree of difficulty again with the idol. Like, I can't believe I'm going this hard to bat for Troy Zan, but I still feel like he got totally jobbed.
Now, we are not natural Troy sympathizers, but when he was watching this and he sees Ty just like effortlessly find two items or two clues at least back to back, he must be pissed that he had to jump through so many hoops and like expose himself. Well, not expose himself, but he had to put himself at so much risk, let's say, to find his idol, whereas Ty can just waltz around in the forest and find it easily.
Yeah. So JT does find this idol. He gives it the kiss of death. Have you heard about the kiss of death yet, Dom, this season, this new editing trick?
Is this better or worse than the bug theory?
I've seen it from Jeff Pittman has been the one that I've seen it from, where we had Sierra Dawn Thomas give Malcolm a kiss right as the last vote was about to get read for him on the cheek, for the record, at the last tribal council. And then I think it was either Caleb or Tony on their way out got kissed on the cheek too at some point. And now JT kisses his idol, and that is the last we ever see of that idol.
Well, we saw Caleb kiss Ty on the forehead on the way out, right? So is Ty doomed? Are we meant to cross him off our list now?
Ooh, maybe that's not a bad call. I think that might have been the one that I was remembering from earlier, but if it was, I guess I was remembering it as Ty kissing Caleb, and that was the end. Well, and that was the end of Caleb.
Well, I would love it if it was Ty kissing Caleb, and that leads to Caleb getting voted out. But on his way out, he kisses Ty, and now Ty is marked for death himself.
Right. I mean, I think there's a very long chain here of kisses going around and just ruining everyone. God, oh my God! If we ever started factoring in like off-island activities, everyone here would be.
So when Dawson kissed Jeff at the reunion, is Jeff now like, is he a marked man?
Oh, well, I think that is like backwards, where since she goes by her last name, it actually makes Jeff immortal. I think that actually triggered the final step of immortality. So that is JT kisses his idol goodbye. And then apparently, as you've mentioned, I think you've mentioned, he goes and buries it at the top of a mountain for some reason. It seems like I know, as we'll get to later, like I have a very hard time docking returning players' points on return shots when they are in there, like as a known commodity, especially JT, who's in there as a known previous winner and a huge game player. But this seems like totally amateur hour, right? Like hiding your idol at the top of a mountain.
So I think the logic was he went up there because he knew that Sandra like wouldn't go up there, probably couldn't go up there if she wanted to, and same goes for Varna. So like, it just wasn't going to be found there. But then, yeah, if it's half an hour before tribal and you realize, oh shit, maybe I need my idol, it does make it a little bit more difficult to recover it. And
right, now you can't go up there even if you wanted to.
Right. And we heard this from Stephen as well, actually, who, when he found his advantage, apparently he hid it somewhere where it wasn't that easily accessible. And so there was some tribal where, like, with half an hour left to go, he didn't want to draw attention to himself, and also his feet were messed up, so he didn't want to inflict all of this pain on himself to go and find it. So I'm starting to wonder now, is this an actual thing that people need to be thinking about, like the geography or the logistics of where to actually hide something if you find it?
I think, yeah, definitely. I would recommend don't hide it very far away. I would say bury it deep, but nearby, like, you know, not within easily, you know, scene distance, where if it takes you a few minutes to dig it up, you don't want it to be a high likelihood that someone walks up on you. But I think like when Malcolm found out that they were going to merge in Philippines, he just ran pretty quickly away and dug up his idol. I think like that's the move, is have it. I don't even know what a good distance away would, like I've not been on a campsite often enough to know how far people have access to or whatever, but I would say you shouldn't be more than a couple of minutes walk away from your idol.
I was wondering if maybe, like, if there's a standard place that they do confessionals, if you could hide it just, like, a few minutes away from that, so that when you go to look for it, you can say, oh, they're calling me to do a confessional, and then just go and hide it, or like, when they actually do call you, you can just, on your way back, just take, like, a quick detour, I don't know, maybe there's an obvious reason that wouldn't work, but that thought crossed my mind.
Well, the thing that would stand out to me is, if they weren't calling you to do a confessional when you needed to go get it at the last minute, but they were calling someone else to go do a confessional,
yeah,
like a few feet away.
A little bit awkward, yeah. Or like if there's a place where you get picked up by the vans to go to tribal and you just hide it like 2 minutes away and go there early or something. I don't know.
Dude, glove compartment. Problem solved. Just hide it in
hide
the van.
In the van.
Yeah.
Hope it's not a new fleet or something the next time round.
Yeah, easy game. All right. So let's move along. Let's go to the reward challenge, which is primarily a balance challenge. A lot of balance going on. This is something Rob pointed out this week, and I definitely have to agree. It seems like both of the challenges this week have been balance. It seems like basically nothing but balance and water so far. Definitely good times to be Ozzy yet again.
And good times to be Debbie, because she crushes every balance challenge, and she's a world-renowned expert at this.
Yeah, well, let's get into that, because as each of the tribes is deliberating on who should do what part of the challenge, we go to the green team. And by the way, I wish we got to see more of this, just in general, of the teams deliberating during challenges. But I guess we get to see it when it's pertinent. And here we saw Zeke on the green team say that he's great at slide puzzles, that he practices them on his phone. And we go on to see that Zeke absolutely delivers on that. We see Michaela, when we get our look into the blue team, saying that she would be great at digging in the sand. That turns out to be accurate, Dom. So two for two there. And now we go to the red team's huddle, and Debbie is saying she's got amazing balance skills. And so what did we end up making of this? Because I know, as a recent watcher of the new episode of Rick and Morty, that comedy comes in threes, Dom. So what are we making of this kind of trifecta here of prophecies before this challenge? Because this ends up becoming the major storyline, is Debbie ostensibly failing on that balance beam, although somewhat controversial, I guess, about how long she and Haley were actually on there. But this definitely seems to be what the editors are wanting us to focus on, is that Debbie is almost obsessing over how this balance ended up going, and this becomes the big talking point over at Red.
And I love that they resurrected the Dan Foley maneuver of actually going to the tape and showing like the comment that was made to put it in the appropriate context. Which I really hope this becomes a new standard, by the way, of like someone says something which is blatantly just wrong or hypocritical, and they just like cut to the fact checking segment where they just completely bury them.
Right. Well, first of all, shout out to everyone who tweeted at me or us saying that it was very genius-esque, and hopefully we can evolve even more into incorporating flashbacks into Survivor. But I do think it's really important that they chose to do that, that they, as they were gearing us up for Debbie's about to freak out on Brad Culpepper and, you know, drag his name totally through the mud, they wanted to refresh the audience on Debbie is completely in the wrong here. Everything she's saying is not at all backed up by the thing that we already showed you once and are now going to remind you of.
Well, so in the context of charity seeming like they're going to be getting rich and everyone talking about the Brad Culpepper winner edit potentially, is this just an attempt to bury Debbie, or is this striking down anything that could possibly throw anything about Brad into question?
Well, I don't know. I think it could conceivably be the latter, but my concern is, and this is where the Ken factor or the Malcolm factor of them going so far out of their way, at least in my view, to defy the general expectations that one would have based on someone being edited that way, I feel like we could at least be potentially being set up for why Debbie ends up, devastating Brad Culpepper, and like somehow after this swap, working it to however it ends up going, where she ends up turning on him, and this is how he leaves in the same way that Malcolm did, and like just sheer bad luck essentially. Like I would definitely give pretty substantial odds that these two swap onto the same tribe next week, right? It seems very unlikely that that's not the case.
And maybe this is the story of Brad actually coming back and playing a solid game and right, being a front runner, maybe, and then just getting derailed by Debbie going completely off the rails and putting a brand in hands.
Was Monica, please let this be right, because I really don't know, was Monica the final person to get voted out before the merge in Survivor One World?
She was not, no.
Okay, well, I was wrong, so there's no... When did she get... I have no knowledge. I do not remember. It was in that, like, 4-7 range, right? When did she...
No, I rely on you for the trivia.
It was definitely post-swap, pre-merge. I'm going with... I definitely can lock that much in, but I feel like to go back to the hashtag, what would Monica do in the season premiere... I read that as possible losing finalist to fulfill the Monica prophecy the same way she was, but maybe that's possible late pre-merge casualty the way Monica was. Do you have the results, by the way, on when Monica got voted out on Survivor One World? Show me sixth overall. That's my read.
So according to a frantic Wikipedia search, she technically was the last person voted out because Colton got medevaced 2 days later. So
nailed it.
So you're technically right, which is the best kind of right. So yeah, maybe that's the fate that Brad gets to live here. And that I would almost, that would almost be fitting, right? Because if Brad does go on to win somehow, or like he does make a deep run, okay, I think people would have changed their views about him and he's redeemed himself as a character or as a player and so on. But it would almost be fitting if he looks like he's about to play a good game and then something just completely unpredictable and unplayaroundable happens that that curtails that.
Yeah. Well, what do you think? Because this is obvious, this is not going to be the last we see of this storyline. But if you had to make a call, I do keep having to go back to when thinking about like the long term edit of this season, even all of like the pre-merge last season, I feel like we were pretty adamant saying it, Adam or Ken is winning and there is no other candidate. David is the bubble guy. That's it. And then at the merge, we just ruled out Adam and said, okay, it has to be Ken now. Do you feel like what we're seeing with Brad is really going to be what we're getting? Like the edit is just that obvious.
I honestly think moving ahead, not just for this season, but also for future seasons, it might be better if we just forget that Millennials versus Gen X ever happened.
Why?
Not to throw shade on friend of the show, Adam Klein, but just from an editing standpoint, like, I think if you let yourself like relive that over and over, it's just going to like, people have moved past it. The two of us are stuck in our failure in that season, but no one else is. Like, everyone else has moved on by now, so I think should as well.
I mean, I'm not trying to bring up our failure in that. I'm just saying, for me, that plays a huge role. And I would also sidebar add, Adam winning Survivor seems like pretty easily the best thing that happened in 2016. Like, one of very few good things that happened in 2016.
Right, it's like it had to end on a high note somehow, and that's what the universe went with.
Okay.
What the universe went worth, if you prefer. But yeah,
I do not. I do not prefer.
Okay. So the question for me is, let's say Brad does get taken down by Debbie. What does that say about Brad? Because part of Survivor is managing the people who seem like they can't be managed, and you know, one of the best things about Coach and Sophie and Albert as a team in South Pacific was being able to manage Brandon Hans, and there have been other people too, like Fairplay and Burton were doing so well because they were able to harness Lil effectively, and then the one time they let that slip, that was the end for the two of them. Right, so this is clearly an important skill to have in a lot of situations, but like, it feels to me like, let's say Debbie does turn on Brad and get him voted out somehow, that's not going to be a mark against Brad in my book. That's just Debbie just being Debbie somehow.
Well, does Brad now need to, like, is it bad for his image if they show up at whatever the next swap is and he's there saying, guys, I know we've been talking about Nuku strong, but Debbie's really got to go, when everyone else is probably just going to see her? She's solely focused on Brad. Why the hell would we want her out? She's never coming at me while he's still in the game.
So it depends who the other people on the tribe are. I think if it's other old Nuku or new mana people, so if it's like Haley and Sierra and Ty, like they would just be on board with Brad over Debbie, certainly. But I think the issue for Brad is, let's say it's Brad and Debbie and then a bunch of people from Tavua and the other tribe, like that's a situation where Debbie could just start running to them and saying, okay, Brad was the leader on that team, I don't want to be with him anymore, let's vote him out. And they would probably go along with it because it would make sense for them, and it would certainly make sense in whatever twisted universe Debbie inhabits too.
So to bring up my favorite question of all time that we haven't gotten to ask nearly enough in these recent seasons, Dom, should Brad have wanted to lose this immunity challenge to get rid of Debbie before she can do any kind of drastic damage to him once she's with new people?
Well, it feels like Debbie was doing her best to lose it on his behalf, but that might actually be a good call, because if it's... I guess the problem is they don't know how soon the next twist is, whether it's a swap or like an early merge or whatever it happens to be. So like, let's say you throw this and you vote out Debbie. Okay, great. But then let's say you lose again.
Who cares? Now you vote out Haley.
You vote out Haley, but then it's starting to get dicey, because like maybe you're voting out Haley, who maybe potentially could have stuck with you, as opposed to, you know, you don't even know what's going on the other tribes. And then let's say you lose again, or like the merge is at 12 or 11 or something, then that's actually pretty risky at that point. So I don't know. I think you do your best in this challenge, and then if you want to throw a challenge to vote out Debbie, you can just do that next week and get the same result.
I don't know. I feel like you are opening the door for that swap to come, which I think you could very reasonably anticipate. And to go back to it, like, if we lose again, fine, we'll go vote out Haley. If we lose again, fine, I can realistically take my pick between which of Sierra, Don Thomas, or Ty I want there with me. And at that point, we will force them to then either swap or merge us, because they will not run the risk of us going to tribal council as two people.
So here's my question about Debbie. Are you enjoying her this season? Is she actually still funny to watch for you, if she ever was?
No, I think this is something that, like, I was fine. I understood completely why they would bring Debbie back. And I definitely do think she brought a lot to Ko Rong. But I definitely was not someone who needed, and I would say the same thing about Ty. Like, I don't think preseason I was someone who needed either of these two back. And I think I have honestly changed my mind about Ty. Like, I think he is in there with a pretty interesting story going on. And I think is not slowing down, as I would have maybe even expected him to do within the game. And, like, I'm really interested in seeing that play out. But Debbie, I've really stayed solid on, I did not need her back on this season. I would have, and she is certainly not alone in fitting this mold, but I would have much rather seen a real Survivor player than Debbie back on this season.
Well, maybe this says something about me and other members of the audience, but I was fine seeing Debbie back when I was happy to laugh at her. Now that it's uncomfortable to watch, legitimately, like, watching Debbie just, like, freak out at Brad and everyone else, like, that was not fun for me. It wasn't scary, but it was just like, I don't need to be watching this. If I want to watch people just, like, break down and have these just serious issues, I can do that. I can do that in other places, not when I'm watching what is meant to be my favorite show. So, I'm over Debbie at this point, and if she gets medevac somehow, or if something happens, then I would be more than okay with it.
Yeah, I mean, I remember, and I was very happy that we didn't have, that these times did not last long, and they had long since been forgotten. But back in that season 26 era, with Brandon Hance and Philip Shepherd and Shamar, like, every single week we were talking about how uncomfortable it was watching people just have meltdowns, like, psychotic episodes on television.
Right, and it was more than just, like, this is a boring episode, or I don't like what happened, or I'm upset that this person got voted out. It was, I legitimately am not having fun watching this. And as someone who is a longtime fan of the show, who hopes to always be a longtime fan of the show, and who cares about it enough to have these long public discussions about it every single week, like, I don't want that to feel like a chore. I want to have fun talking about it and not feel like I'm going through some kind of therapy session.
Yeah, well, I think they have definitely been trying to hit the audience with the impression that Debbie is the one who is almost, like, hallucinating here. Like, they show that flashback, or they show her as she's the first one in the immunity challenge to make it over the wall. If she even was, I only caught her claiming to be the first one to make it over the wall. She goes to Brad and says, "Hey, did you notice I was the first person over the wall?" And Brad says to her, like, "I love you. I don't know why you're yelling at me." Like, it seems like they're definitely making us feel like it's almost entirely in her head that people are even out for her. Yeah, and more to the point, more so on that is her claim that she took 30 seconds to get through the balance beam and the reward challenge, which she never ended up completing, and that Haley took 10 minutes to do hers, when the edit, at least, definitely did not suggest that that was the case. And it really seems like they would not, think that the audience would take Debbie's side in any way in that situation. Like, I think they would think that the audience would totally trust the edit and think that Debbie is crazy. And so I would definitely, at the end of the day, be leaning that this is probably just going to be good news for Brad Culpepper and making him look good by comparison.
And we see the Brad and the rest of Mana can't figure out if Debbie genuinely is that crazy, or if this is some, like, weird acting job that she's putting on for some weird, I don't even know why she would, but, like, they're just, they're not only are they uncomfortable, they're just confused. They don't even know how to process it, because it's not like the usual thing of someone is mad about losing a challenge and they have an argument with someone, because you kind of expect that comes with the territory. But this is unlike anything that they've seen from a rational human being, like from an adult, and that's what makes it so weird.
Yeah, well, I mean,
I did like Debbie's Britishism, though, like calling Brad, "He's a wanker," which. Of course, it's Debbie who would bring that into the lexicon. But yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Well, no, I was just going to say, I think it is just in general, as much as I talk about, you know, being glad that the Brandon Hance days are generally over, and you gave credit to Sophie and Coach and Albert earlier for, you know, being able to keep him in line. But these are the types of players that if I was in there would be the first people I would want out of the game, is these wild cards that are so liable to blow up at it. Like, these are the least reliable people you can have as allies, as far as I'm concerned. Like, they are so able to just turn completely on a dime and seem so unresponsive to general, like, game logic, like, wouldn't even consider that a worthwhile priority. Those would be the last people I would ever want to play with. And so that, I mean, I would be very tempted to throw this challenge.
It does make you wonder as well that I imagine there have been a lot of early boots who, if they had lasted to, like, day 27 instead of day 7, might have had the same Debbie style meltdown, and so maybe it's better for them and for the maybe it's better for them, for everyone else around them, and for the show that they were early boots and didn't get to experience that kind of meltdown, I suppose.
Are you throwing shade at Diane Ogden right now, Dom? Is that what you're doing?
All I'm saying is, maybe one day of Wonder Show was enough for everyone. Okay.
Was it even one day? Did she get to like hour 12 on that? When was it?
Like 1 hour then. Okay, this may be more accurate.
Was it literally they got? Remind me, did they draft as soon as they hit the beach, or did they all get to spend the first night? They got to at least spend one night, right?
I don't think it was even the first night. I think it was just like walking around gathering supplies or whatever, and then it came to that. But regardless, like, but one better example actually might be Kathy Sleckman, who I think, so you can criticize her for quitting all you like, but I think had she stayed there, she legitimately would have had some kind of psychotic episode or something. I don't want to use the wrong term for it, but like I think it. Like, we see the people out there who manage to survive through the experience and who survive through the psychological screening that Survivor puts people through. I wonder if Debbie, like, would Debbie actually pass that exam if she had to go through it again?
Apparently so. Like, it seems like that she did. Like, I do buy that they do put them through the psych exam. I just don't know, like, if Brandon Hance 2.0 was able to pass it and get back out there. It seems like there is no timeline where he was going to even make it 29 days without self-destructing.
It may be that there just isn't a good way of screening how people are going to react in that kind of situation. However, on a returning player season, I feel like you have a good sense of how people are going to react in general. And so, like, so I think putting Shamar out there was a mistake, but something which you can understand how that happened. But like bringing Brandon back, or bringing, I don't think bringing Debbie back is in the same league. Like, I think Debbie is just acting stupidly, and that's who she is, as opposed to Brandon, who was going through something serious. But it's like, I feel like you could have seen this coming, maybe.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with that. But I to go back to it, I definitely was not surprised at all that they brought Debbie back out on the season. I don't think that they saw this kind of thing coming, and maybe it is the case that these were just the very choice selections, and Debbie was kind of in on the joke, or like winking at the camera, and they just didn't show it or whatever. Like, I don't think it is fair to Debbie to say, to compare her to that extent to Brandon Hance of like irresponsible to put her back on the show. I think that's definitely
No. Yeah. I'm not saying that. I just wonder if maybe this is the real Debbie all along, and that what we saw in Ko Rong was like this very sanitized version of Debbie, where we saw all of the funny parts, we got to laugh at her, but we didn't see the actual stuff that made people so just confused and scared by her that they wanted to vote her out in a situation which otherwise looked strategically like, why would you vote Debbie out there? Like, maybe she was seriously that bad that they just didn't really have any other choice.
Yeah, I mean, I think it may be that kind of thing that I was talking about, of like, she's so unpredictable and so irrational that now, you know, I can at least have more faith in the other eight people that we'd be leaving in to understand what I'm putting down. Whereas Debbie is just a total loose cannon. I think that could definitely have come into play there as well.
So one final thought on this reward challenge. So the reward here is PB&J. And after my 3 weeks in the States, I've gained an appreciation for all of your crazy American customs. I don't think I'll ever understand the appeal of PB&J. Like, the peanut butter part, okay, that's fine, that's good, that has the seal of approval. Why would you put jelly in there with that, though? Like, what? Explain this to me.
Well, hang on. So you are a vegetarian, a staunch vegetarian, but you don't like fruit, or what? What's the scoop here? I would have thought that the jelly would be what you would be all about, that you would just eat raw jelly all the time. That's what I imagine vegetarians eat. What else do you even eat? What else is there, like, that's not meat?
Like, no one would enjoy eating just jelly by itself, right? Like, you want the peanut butter part. That's what you're there for. That's the whole point of the experience. Like, the jelly is just like an afterthought that you add because that's the custom and everyone else adds it too. Like, I don't know.
I mean, I feel, incidentally, I'm pretty sure we did a story on the news this week that this, like, is, or one of the days this week was, like, National Peanut Butter and Jelly Day. So there was, like, a weird coincidental timing on that. But I don't know, Dom. I feel like that might be one of the hottest takes that you've ever put out there, that the jelly is the trap. Like, I say this as someone who, I was probably, like, 10 or 11 or 12 before I even was brave enough to put the jelly half on. I always went straight peanut butter on my sandwich, just unadventurous taste buds or whatever was going on. But I would definitely say, with, you know, almost 30 years of life experience now under my belt, that if I could do it all over again, I would have been going even harder on the jelly from an even younger age, man. What's not to love about the jelly? It's such a great dichotomy with, is that the right word, with the peanut butter?
I'm not sure if it's the right word, but we'll allow it. We'll go with it.
It's close enough. It's an acceptable word. Yeah. Anyway, sorry. So what was your, do you have any other scathing takes about the inadequacy of jelly or anything along those lines that you want to get out there in case anyone was curious as to which of the two of us they should like more, despite which of us has the British accent?
Not for now. Although one other thing on this reward is Zeke crushing the slide puzzle, which Zeke, as he acknowledges, crushes every puzzle. And that's not just him boasting. He actually, that's not just him talking the talk. He actually walks the walk there as well. Like he, as he says, he has not lost a challenge where he gets to do the puzzle at the end. So quietly, Zeke is one of the best, maybe not the best overall challenge performer, but certainly killing it on the puzzles. But that slide puzzle, this comes up seemingly almost every season or every other season, and every single time it's like you see people who just have no idea how to do it. And if you want to get an edge in Survivor Challenges, that feels like an easy thing to take 50 minutes out of your life to learn how to do.
Yeah, I did want to, but chose not to bring this up. I mean, the week after the Spencer winning the five-piece puzzle, the other thing that I said to him was, and definitely study the slide puzzle, definitely be perfect on that. And the very next week, he won the slide puzzle immunity. But I felt like I had already been a huge whore the previous week, so I didn't bring that up. But yeah, absolutely. This, I asked on Twitter a couple of weeks ago what the last season that didn't have a slide puzzle was, and was very quickly owned by the aforementioned Jeff Pittman, who said, "Co wrong, did not have a slide puzzle." But I feel like every season dating back to like Redemption Island at least has had a slide puzzle other than that Co wrong fluke for whatever reason. This is probably the most mandatory puzzle to solve. Anyone taking Survivor preparation seriously, make fire and study this puzzle specifically, the slide puzzle. Learn how to do it.
Right, it's either people who go on Jeopardy and have never considered the question of how to wager before. It's like this, you know that this is going to be part of the experience, so just learn how to do it.
Right, yeah. So yeah, but to go back to your larger point, very impressive stuff by Zeke, still I believe undefeated on the puzzle, so that is certainly a streak watch to keep an eye out for. Who are considered the best puzzle doers of all time? Like, do we have any Aussies of I tweeted out Zeke is the Aussie of puzzles, just I heard that stat.
So isn't Ozzy himself on that list as well? Like, isn't Ozzy meant to be the Ozzy of puzzles?
Maybe he is. Maybe, I mean, it wouldn't shock me at all if Ozzy was the all-time record holder for, like, puzzle completion wins just because of all those challenges he got to do on Redemption Island. I also feel like Steven was very adamant that Joey Amazing was, like, a savant on the puzzles.
Yeah. And just to close out the challenge discussion for this episode, it struck me that Ozzy, as this historically great challenge performer, like that's why you bring him back, that's why he's there, it feels like there's been surprisingly little emphasis on just his overall challenge performance so far. And maybe they're saving that for if he gets to the merge, he's able to beast the individual challenges. But so far, like, we saw him really come through for Taboo, or Tavow, if you're CBS, in this episode. And it feels like that just never really gets highlighted. And you really would expect it to, given who Ozzy is and how popular he is and how much they seem willing to push him with the whole survivalist aspect and so on.
Well, I mean, a couple of weeks ago we were in here saying, hey, what's up with no Ozzy hero montage of him swimming out in the deep blue sea or him climbing really high up in the trees? And then the very next week we got that. Ozzy so far has still not been to a vote. I would suspect that, hey, he's probably got a 50-50 chance in the dark, if not higher, just by the virtue of being on that tribe of not going to the next vote, too. I think it could be a while before we start hearing about how incredible Ozzy's been on challenges, because I think he's going to still probably be in there for a little while. But this is probably actually a good transition into the Green Team in general for our 15 minutes a week that we get to spend talking about the Green Team, because we still never see anything from them. But what are you making of Ozzy in particular? Like, is the fact that we're not hearing more from him about how he's keeping his whole tribe safe and well fed, is that bad news for you? Because to me, it definitely seems like we're seeing plenty, you know, at least enough from Ozzy.
We're seeing enough from Ozzy, given that we're seeing literally nothing from anyone else on his tribe.
Exactly.
So, yeah, I feel like Ozzy's in a decent spot. But this whole Green Team in general, like, the thing I referenced just now is, on the CBS website, when they were selling the T-shirts for the season, they misspelled the name of the Green Team, which I'm sure was just an accident, and it could have easily happened to any of the tribe names. But it feels so fitting that this is a team that gets that kind of forgetfulness, because it's like, I don't think anyone else, even the Green Team themselves, knows what their own tribe name is at this point, because we've just seen nothing from them.
I am a person who spent $32 on my very own Tavow tribe t-shirt on the misprint. I love it. I can't wait.
Well, that's going to be a priceless historical artifact in like 30 years from now when we're on season 126 and it's Boston Rob's five kids fighting each other on the same season.
Yeah.
But it's like, I'm sure like Ceree, for instance, would much rather be forgotten and not be on the show than have to actually go to tribal council and be at risk. So I'm sure they're all happy enough to be winning. But it does mean that we just get nothing from them at all. And I don't know. So we get like, so I know people were talking about Sarah this week because she gets the one obligatory Tavua scene this episode where
Sarah is how it's pronounced.
Thank you. So she wants to have options and she wants to have a backup plan in case things fall through, which is always a good impulse to have. So she goes and talks to Troy and kind of puts the feelers out there, tries to get some kind of connection with him. So great stuff from Sarah, and I've seen people like jump on this as, oh look, this is Sarah as like a possible winner candidate, or this is Sarah like this is someone that we're meant to watch. But if you actually think about the depth of the content, this is so shallow. This is like something which we could never ever see again. Like Troy could get voted out, or they could end up in opposite tribes, and like nothing more could ever come of this.
Isn't that a great indicator then that they are showing it? Doesn't it mean that something must come of this if they're showing it right before we're about to? What odds do you need that those two aren't on the same tribe?
So this could be because it is important, and so this is the time they have to show it. But it could also be like, they have to show something from this tribe, and so this is literally the only thing that there is to show, because who else is even strategizing, or who even has anything else to say? Or it could be that, like, let's say they have to go to tribal next week, and Troy is thinking, does he use his idol? And maybe Sarah's the one who talks him into not using it, and he ends up going home, or, like, that's the central focus there.
Right. I definitely do not believe that this is in there because they thought this was the best they could do, and, oh, if we have to spend a couple of minutes on these six people that we hate as editors, I guess we can show Sarah talking to Troy Zan, even though it's not going to matter. Like, I don't think that is even remotely in the realm of possibility. I think there is a ton that they would love to be showing from this tribe, and the fact that it is Sarah talking to Troy Zan, I think that definitely means that it's going to have some kind of larger ramification. And I have to say, like, my mind was blown upon finding out this week from great friend of the show Pia Virolainen that according to Edgic, Sarah is like one of the leading candidates. I would have definitely said until maybe Zeke and Ceree and Andrea all going totally invisible this episode that Sarah had been the quietest person leading up to this week. However, I guess she had some really solid confessionals in the first couple of episodes, and critically, we heard from her about what she thought when Tony got voted out, which I guess is like similar to the bug thing. Like, Edgic is convinced that if it's an all-star kind of pair thing, you have to hear from the other person, and she got that check mark. So I guess there is a ton of reason for people out there to be believing in Sarah Lucina. Is that ringing true for you at all, or is this people just seeing what reading too much into it, or seeing what they want to see, or what?
So my $1.50 that I invested in her would love that to be true, certainly. But to me, this feels like people are just jumping on whatever option is springing up that week. Because, like, so 2 weeks ago, when there had been no Sarah at all, and it felt like everyone's edit on that tribe was dropping off a cliff, I don't think anyone was saying, oh, well, clearly, you know, Sarah's the one to be looking out for. She's this dark horse, under-the-radar winner pick. And I think next week, if we get this Andrea scene that just comes out of nowhere, then Andrea's going to be the new person that people are going to. So I don't know. This feels like the flavor of the week to me. If this becomes a constant thing, like we always get to hear Sarah's thoughts randomly when it doesn't make any sense, then that's, yeah, we'll start looking more at that. But for now, it doesn't. I'm going to reserve judgment for the time being.
Okay. Yeah, I definitely think, like, had I not heard that, I don't think she would have been in my top 6, 7, 8, I mean, at least that pantheon of winner candidates right now. But again, I genuinely feel like, give me shit all you want or whatever for like overreacting to Ken, but I really feel like basically all bets are off as far as conventional. Well, what? Go ahead. Sorry.
No, I'm saying it's not like Edgic had a better time last season than you did. So.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, Edgic was all in on, not all in, but Edgic was very high on David last season. So, I mean, that's my point. Like, that's what I'm saying, is it seems like the conventional things, like what we saw last week where Sandra got 20 different quotes, that had anyone said any of those things in the first 32 seasons, they definitely would have left that night. They are actively toying with us now. So I definitely think anything is in play here.
It does strike me that so the two like big pieces of Sarah content that we have are both her basically repeating the same thing, talking about she's going to play like a criminal rather than a cop. So maybe this is a precursor to the same kind of President Sarah blow up that we see that we saw at the Merge in her first season, where like she tries to play in this kind of more aggressive way, but she overplays her hand or she gets too cocky, and that's the big thing that like detonates at the Merge or at some important point in the game.
Well, she did tell us that her social game is phenomenal, so I'm pretty optimistic that going forward she's going to be able to lure in whoever she wants.
Was that intentional, the accent?
Yes, or... thank you very much.
Okay,
though,
that was flawless. I said, like, if that was accidental, that was very impressive.
All right. I don't have that much. I genuinely feel like I have virtually no accent. That's how I feel. I think that's pretty indicative of my general worldview. Just everything revolves around me and you're all the weird ones.
Are you familiar with the idea of received pronunciation?
No, but please enlighten me and the rest of us. I'm sure all the viewers or listeners know, but please tell me.
So it's this concept in the UK where like the BBC is often criticized for not having this wide range of regional voices. And it's always like the same kind of very cut glass, like home county style accent, which doesn't really have any distinguishing qualities to it. It's just generic, vaguely posh sounding person talking. And I feel like I have transcended that to be super posh, so I can't meet that criticism. But that's the thing. It's like people who literally seem to have no accent, whereas someone from like Liverpool or Leeds or London is deemed to have like a very strong accent, and that makes them weird somehow.
Well, so what do you want? You want Nikki Graham narrating Planet Earth just for like equality's sake, or what?
I want Nikki Graham narrating Planet Earth, Songs of Praise, The Queen's Speech, ideally. Just basically any Nikki Graham opportunities out there, just pop them on.
Yeah, absolutely. So any other thoughts on like Andrea or Suri or what we really saw literally, or Zeke, I guess we saw other than the puzzle, basically nothing from any of them this week.
Give me stuff to have thoughts about, and yeah. I have thoughts about. I have lots of hot takes, but I need material to work with. Okay, I can't just go in there blind.
I mean, I swear, Andrea got more in the previously on Survivor than she got in the actual episode, right, where they just showed her doing the puzzle again.
Someone made a good joke about Andrea being the person who is on the boat next week. Like, she's not on the season, so it has to be.
That's really good.
They heard a rumor that she was coming in somehow, so this has to be it.
She wasn't on Twitter, guys, during that whole period, so be on the lookout. Yeah. All right. So I guess just quickly, before we dedicate probably most of the rest of this episode to the blue team and Sandra and JT, one thing, I think we're good on the green team, but from the red team that I wanted to bring up is just wondering where you're standing currently on both Haley Ford and Sierra Dawn Thomas, because it really does stand out to me, even in the world where I feel like a lot is way more up in the air than it ever has been before with the edit, I can't help but notice that it feels like these two are getting a pretty generous amount of positive screen time here.
To a point, but like this week, so after the fireworks of the previous tribal, you'd expect there to be a lot of Haley and Sierra offering their thoughts maybe. And I feel like we didn't get too much of that, especially from Sierra. I mean, Haley was enmeshed in the whole like Debbie controversy to an extent, but it felt like they were shown last week when they were in the thick of the action, and then this week when they could have given their thoughts, they weren't given the chance to. Are you thinking differently there?
Well, no, I just feel like we've seen more than I would have expected, and I think you're right. Like, we didn't see a ton from either of them this week, but I think it's because we got so much of the Brad and Debbie show over at the red team, and I think it's totally fine for them to, like, I would be floored if the editors did not give them an episode off, even if they were trying to really put them over as characters. But it just still strikes me that maybe it's going to be because they go, you know, there's an interesting swap, particularly Haley, who, like, you know, now she's essentially a free agent entering this swap. Maybe she finds herself in an interesting spot, and that's why she's become more of a focal point. Or maybe Sierra swaps to be the only person from her previous tribe or whatever, if she has the legacy advantage still, and that's why they're focusing on her. It just always is going to stand out to me, no matter what they do with the edit, anytime that I see someone that it really seems like they would not go out of their way at all to highlight.
Yeah, but instead of reading the tea leaves still, let's talk about Coffeegate, because this is the central focus of the episode here. And for me, this felt like the kind of amateurish feud that you'd expect from like a doomed tribe on an all newbie season, instead of between someone who was meant to be like one of the top tier winners coming into an all-star season. Like, this feels very out of out of character and out of place.
Yeah, I mean, let's get into this, where Sandra recognizes that JT's mad about how much of the sugar Michaela's been using with her coffee, with her seven drops of coffee or whatever. JT's certainly not making any bones about it. So Sandra decides that she's going to clean out the entire sugar bowl. He's, of course, going to think it had to be Michaela, and he's going to freak out, and that's going to cause a rift with them, and the queen's going to stay the queen. Adios. And I really want to emphasize, like, I do think that if you are going to make this kind of move, Sandra did a really good job of doing it. And I do love seeing out of Sandra, someone that I generally criticize for not thinking this way, of seeing her really act in a, not like self, like, I definitely think she is always self-interested, but in an actively self-interested way where she is taking action to make things go her way. I love seeing this out of Sandra, and I definitely do have a lot of complimentary things to say about how she did this episode. I do also, though, have some questions about if this is even a great idea in the first place.
I don't know if it's a great idea, but this is variations on a theme, right? And I think this is worlds apart from like knocking over the fish and then because she was mad and then like blaming Krista and somehow Krista actually gets a blame for that somehow, or like putting Russell's hat in the fire because she's mad at Russell, which who can really blame her for, but it's still not a, it's not a strategic idea, that's just her being upset. This felt like, okay, I'm trying to turn JT against Michaela. How can I do that? Well, I can do this thing, which is we already know is in my arsenal from my previous two seasons. And this felt like she was like coming up with an idea and following through on it and trying to achieve an objective. And that's very different from what I think people have in mind when they think about this anyone but me idea of just like sitting back and not trying to affect the game in any way. And as long as I personally am safe and I don't care what's going on, Sandra clearly does care what's going on. She wants to protect Michaela. She wants to get out JT, and she puts the steps in place to go about doing that. And she does it. I don't know if it's even surprisingly well. Maybe it's surprising to us, given our views on Sandra from the past. But either way, the execution here is pretty impressive.
Yeah, I mean, I really want to stress that I'm really trying to give Sandra as much credit as I possibly can over the course. I'm really trying to err on the side of seeing things Sandra's way and not just be some petty Sandra hater. But I do, to go back to a couple other things that may not be ideal about this, why do it, first of all, in front of Jeff Varner is a question that I would have, because I know maybe it will like strengthen their bond or whatever, but for someone who famously said loose lips sink ships, which is something I totally agree with in Survivor, Sandra, I believe was an episode title in Heroes versus Villains that she got, Jeff Varner seemed about as loose as lips get. That seems like maybe for the time being, you're doing a good job of getting him on your side, but then also, and maybe this will answer my own question now that I'm thinking about it, then at Tribal Council, after JT's gone, she confesses that it was her, and to her credit, like, everyone on the tribe, Jeff already knew, Michaela and Aubrey both seemed, like, cool with it and impressed by it, but she cannot rely on that being their reaction, but maybe it was to disarm Jeff Varner so he couldn't use it against her later, she already told them.
And maybe it's a sign of overconfidence that, oh, of course, Jeff is going to be okay with it, but I'm wondering if maybe Sandra and Varner is like the tightest alliance on that tribe, and it's one that we've seen it's kind of getting less emphasis than maybe it should. And so later on, when Jeff is talking about how he would love to vote out both of them, and he would, yeah, he's in the middle, he's playing both sides, maybe that was just a red herring. Maybe he was locked in on the Sandra group the whole time, and so JT's idea that, oh, of course Varner's going to be okay with coming over here and voting out Michaela, maybe that's another kind of big misread there by JT.
Oh, Jeff Varner's confessional about, so my two options are, I can vote with Sandra and Michaela and take JT out, or I can vote with JT and Aubrey. Like, he was so vividly aware in that moment that he was getting the set it up for the audience, what are the two options confessional. Right, I did not buy for a second that he was actually considering keeping JT.
I'm sure he set his DVR for like exactly 38 minutes into the episode because he knew that was when the confessional was going to come up. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I think you probably are on to something. I'm definitely buying that Jeff Varner and Sandra and maybe even Michaela now would be an incredibly tight trio were they able to all draw the same color buff going into this next round.
Yeah, I think that's a good read, and I'm interested to see where all of them end up next week, if that is, in fact, what's happening. Let's talk about whether you think this actually was a good idea, though, because so it felt like this feels like the kind of thing which you only do if you think it's going to work, and it's only going to work if there's already this festering feud there between the two people. So I wonder, so it's obviously good TV, and Sandra gets to play to the audience, but was this even that necessary, do you think?
Probably not.
if this never happens and Sandra goes to JT and says, hey, how about we vote out Michaela? Like, JT obviously is going to be on board with that, I think. It's not like this was the one big catalyst that, that drove all of that forward.
Well, consider what JT did a couple of nights ago to try to get Sandra out. Like, I don't think it's a foregone conclusion that if Sandra came to JT and said, hey, you'll stick with the majority for this one round if you're willing to vote out Michaela now, that he would necessarily be totally cool with that. I think if he thought it was legit, he would go along with it. But it really did seem like his sights were set on her. And I think this does do a good job of deflecting. I do, though, really question how worth it was, but in thinking about it, like how much it really adds to that feud, and maybe it did, like it certainly added a ton to the TV episode, but at the same time, what has she got to lose? Like, obviously the target on her is not going to change.
And also, so like if JT's thinking about this sensibly, which clearly he maybe wasn't entirely in this case, but like, I feel like for JT to trick himself into thinking that everyone really wants to vote out Michaela, it can't be a strategic thing, right? Like, it's not, oh, we're voting out Michaela because she's this massive threat, or we're voting out Michaela because she's too close to people on the other side, because all of those things are more true of JT. It has to be, we're voting out Michaela because she has done something to annoy us, or it was, as a tribe, we're just not comfortable with her being here anymore. And this is a good, like, thing that you can invent or make up to make it sound like that's the case.
Right. I think JT fell victim to something that I had previously talked about with regard to Ozzy. But it really seemed to me like JT thought, I am so valuable for this tribe, especially now that we've lost Malcolm, in both the challenges and I think like providing for them to a certain extent, that regardless of what their alliances are, it is too early to take me out. Like, they are just sending themselves back to every tribal council if they take me out. But again, I think that's not necessarily the worst plan a lot of the times, is to voluntarily go to these tribal councils.
And the thing is that that's always going to be true for JT, right? He's always going to be a good provider for that tribe. He's always going to be great in the challenges. So if that's the case, then why was he thinking when he swelled onto that tribe, oh, I'm in dire straits now because it's 5v1, or why was he shipwrecking his tribe to go and look for the idol, or why was he so desperate to find it in this very episode, right? Like, none of that is consistent with thinking they have to keep me around because I'm the best provider, because that's always going to be true.
Right.
So,
I mean, to go back to it, I really think that they must have just put the full court press on JT and making him feel like there was no chance he was leaving.
Yeah, and all credit to them for doing that, because clearly it worked very well. And I've seen some debate on Twitter this week about whether this is JT just being a bad player in the context of the season, or if it was JT still being a good player, but just being hoodwinked by a better player in Sandra, who, if you ask a lot of people, is the best player of all time, and there's no one even in the same tier as her.
I mean, you have to certainly deduct some points for leaving his idol on the top of a damn mountain when he swapped onto a team knowing he was the only one from his own tribe, especially when he, you know, given the craziness and how vocal they were about how unhappy they were with him after that Malcolm vote, to then, as we talked about earlier, you know, 2 days later, he is so confident that he doesn't even think it's worth bringing his idol to tribal council. I think you absolutely have to give him credit for that. And to go to the deducting points, like, I really have a very hard time bringing any, especially former winners, reputations down based on future performances when they're known commodities as former winners of the show. It really seems like there were several things this time around that, as I described it earlier, like leaving your idol in particular, just not even bringing it, is complete amateur hour. Like, any truly elite Survivor player would never consider that. I would imagine. I know even Steven, #EvenSteven, first one ever to come up with that rhyme, is defending him to a certain extent both last week and this week. But I really feel like there are a lot of very justifiable gripes with a lot of the ways JT decided to play this time around.
It feels like he's almost regressed as a player since Token Chains, where like the first time he plays this quote unquote perfect game, the second time he comes out swinging and makes some, yeah, he makes this, depending on who you ask, maybe the biggest mistake of all time, certainly a bold, like, big play. And then the third time round, he just kind of fizzles out. And like he considers making these big moves, but doesn't even go through with it. And then when he goes out, it's not because he took a swing and he missed, it's because he just kind of just, he made these elementary mistakes that you just wouldn't associate with someone of that caliber. So
right.
I know it's become cliche to talk about Kim and compare everything to Kim, but let's say Earl, for instance. Can you imagine Earl getting into this kind of argument over something so like utterly inconsequential in a way that just alienates him from everyone else on his tribe? Like, it's just not, like, this isn't something that you associate with a top tier player.
No, I totally agree. And that's, I think, my big question now going forward. And again, I really feel like we have to weigh in. He is doing all of this as someone who has won the game before and knows that he is a tremendously known threat and known quantity out there, who is always going to be near the top of the list for a lot of people, no matter what round of the game it is. But I really feel like we're saying, there are just so many missteps that JT was probably someone for me who, entering this season, would have pretty easily been in my, like, if I had a gun to my head and I had to pick someone who, as a first timer, if they didn't win the season against random players, I would get shot in the head. Like, they must win for me to continue living. He probably would have been a top 10 pick for me. I still feel like, as a first timer, he is not nearly this ambitious within the game than he is as a former winner. But I feel like people like Earl are now going to get, Earl was probably already ahead of him, frankly, but there are going to be some people that are going to get bumped up ahead of JT now, just seeing this go down.
But not even Earl. So there are lots of winners who I think are kind of lower in a lot of people's estimation who would never make that same kind of error. So a lot of the people who get marked down because they didn't make these flashy moves or they played this fairly passive game. So, like, can you imagine Natalie White or Michelle or Amber or whoever, even someone like Bob, right? You can't imagine them making these, just like getting into these fights over pointless stuff and then having that actually inform their voting decision. Like, I thought coming into this round, if JT thought he was in trouble, it would be, okay, I am swinging for the fences at Sandra. I'm going for Sandra. And if it doesn't work, and it probably won't work, then okay, I'm gone. But if it does work, then I overturn the balance of power on this tribe. Instead, it's, I'm going to stake my entire game, my entire third season, on voting out Michaela because she is bad in challenges and annoys me because of the coffee. Like, what? How is that even a thing that goes through his head?
Right. I mean, I think for him, it was just such a foregone conclusion that everyone wants Michaela out. Obviously, why wouldn't they? And the episode really just played up the coffee aspect of it because it was such a great story. Yeah. And it was so well executed by Sandra. But I mean, if I'm going through the all-time list of winners that I could see even getting in an argument about something this meaningless, let alone letting it impact their vote. Obviously, Sandra is number one with the bullet. She has cast so many fuck you votes over the course of her Survivor career. But the only other people I could see even getting into a fight over something this meaningless would be maybe Natalie Anderson, probably Tony, and probably Mike yeah. Holloway.
And I was actually going to bring Natalie up as a contrast, because she's someone who you would think of as, like, getting into fights with people and making decisions based on vengeance in a very Sandra-esque fashion almost. But, like, the one defining thing and the one surprising thing about Natalie, and maybe this wouldn't be true if she came back, maybe she would make this JT style mistake now, but the one, like, the reason she did so well in her first season was she was able to rein that in, and she picked her spots very carefully. Like, she was mad at John over the Jeremy thing, but she saved him for the first vote and then got her revenge a few votes later, right? As she knew when to make her move and when she had to rein it in, and it seemed like JT just didn't really do that this time.
Yeah, and then the other ones, I could certainly see Tony getting in plenty of meaningless arguments. I don't know how much it would have led. I think it would depend on the timing to see how much it would impact his vote. And then Mike Holloway, I could see definitely getting into some useless arguments out on a season of Survivor.
Yeah, I mean, with Tony, it doesn't matter because he has never played for a second time, will never play for a second time, and so right. This is entirely a moot point. It's not even about the specifics of, oh, was it actually the coffee thing that mattered, or was it something else? It's just getting into that kind of fight with people is just not something that you do as an elite player in the way that JT was billed as, and in the way that we, you know, to our detriment maybe, billed him as for a long time too.
Well, I'm curious what happened between... You spent $16.50 on JT in June, but no, to your credit, we just got a tweet sent to us earlier today of like someone took a video of the audio, like some clip somehow of our audio of you talking about JT in our preseason podcast for the Nuku tribe, and you were talking about you just had a horrible gut feeling that JT was going to blow it.
Yeah, and I didn't know how. I didn't know that it was going to be over Coffeegate or whatever. But yeah, I just couldn't shake the sense of, like, JT, he's in this great spot. He has everything going for him on paper, and he should be able to do well, but he just won't. And maybe that's just me kind of getting lucky in my pessimism. Or maybe it's like a subconscious realization that maybe JT isn't as good as the hype from me would lead you to believe. I don't know.
I mean, I really feel like I don't think I understood the magnitude to which the two of us are like interested in JT and fans of JT until we did those preseason podcasts, because once we were done with them, I went through to get like the timestamps of like where we start and stop talking about each individual person. And the average, you know, most people we did about 10 minutes on, like Tony, we did 15 minutes on. Andrea, we randomly did like 17 minutes on. JT, we did close to half an hour on only JT. And this podcast, I feel like we spent, you know, close to half an hour talking about at least only JT. I really didn't realize how kind of important of a player I think he, or how much we both really took to him in general as a Survivor player, or interested in him for whatever reason. I don't know what it is.
So I think it's like so you see this contrast between someone who, and this is a contrast that JT is aware of and has played up in the past to his credit, of, oh, he's just like the good old country boy who you'd expect to be like this loyal but not very intelligent player, and someone who is able to just kind of run a train on his first season and make these very bold and ambitious plays in his second season. And then the failure of those plays in contrast with his first season, it's like, if you just watched Heroes versus Villains and you said, okay, what's your assessment of this guy as a player? You would think, I would not be putting, like, if there was a gun to my head, I would not be putting my money on this guy to rescue me from that.
Right.
But then you watch his first season, and if that's all you had seen, it's like, okay, this guy is number one with a bullet, if you want to put it in those terms. Like, he is, he's the guy I want if my life is on the line. And so there's always been this question of like, which side of JT is the dominant one, and which one is the one that actually defines him as a player? And this season, it's almost like we saw a third side where he was the Colby, right? He was like, he was washed up. He just didn't really get it together.
Yeah, I mean, this is what it would come down to for me with JT is, I'll take the Token Sheens cast, please. Yes, that's the one I'll have JT playing with my life. I'll take the rich people that I'll just fall in love with him immediately. Yes, thank you. I'll sign me up for that.
So in the light of this, how important do you think Steven was? Because you sent out a tweet saying that, like, the only people who have improved their reputations this season are Brad Culpepper and Steven, which I don't know how much Steven's reputation needed improving or restoring after Cambodia, but it seems like this is doing a pretty good job of it.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like we have always been people who give Steven maybe even too much credit as a player over the years. Certainly before we saw either he or JT, I guess we'd seen JT in Heroes versus Villains return, but not until we'd seen them return again. Like, long before that, I think we were really eager to give Steven a lot of credit for that partnership. And potentially, I think we were probably the most vocal people about bringing up the point that, like, JT went to the end game with the only two people who were not interested in going to the end with him. Like, that was definitely a spot that could have you know, come back to bite him. I feel like, yeah, we have to revisit that. And I know I generally have, I really don't want people's, not that I don't want it, but I don't think it's fair to detract too many points from people based on their second or third or whatever time playing. But I really think we have to go back to just in seeing all of the things that JT has done when acting on his own without Steven as kind of a strategy co-pilot, is we go back to the Suri boot, which we definitely were into in Heroes versus Villains. And like, I think maybe that going well for him almost set him on an irreversible course of doing these crazy things on his return shots that are like such moon shots that are so low percentage.
Well, so I'll come back to that in a second, but I was thinking, like, maybe Malcolm getting taken out was even worse than it seemed for JT, because he needed that kind of sounding board he needed that sense of external control to just rein him in. Because I think if Malcolm is there, like, Malcolm is laid back in the sense that you need to be, of like, he's the one who can go to JT quietly and just say, okay, dude, just like, chill out, right? Don't make this into a thing. And like, and JT, and he's maybe the only person that JT would listen to for that.
Right. I think Aubrey could definitely fit that mold, but I think JT in particular would have an easier time hearing it from Malcolm than from Aubrey.
And Aubrey had a good secret scene this week where she said, like, I want to work with JT, but watching this has been a real eye-opener, because it's like, I don't know if this guy is someone who is stable enough and trustworthy enough that I can actually rely on them as an ally, which is not something you want to hear.
Well, critically, too, as far as losing Malcolm is, I think if things go according to plan and he is able to use that telling Brad and company about the votes going on Sierra, if they just comply with his plan and put the votes on Sandra, then going forward, he and Malcolm and Aubrey have majority on this tribe.
Yeah, we'll certainly revisit that in a second. But so JT in his exit press, in his day after video, he had this quote, and I'll read it out here. I forget that not everyone plays this game to win. If you can't get to the end, you can't win. And I give people way too much credit for wanting to win the game. I make decisions based on, if I was in their shoes, what would I do? Which, it sounds kind of banal, but at the same time, like, that's the fundamental thing that you have to be thinking about, right? But he seems to be kind of warped in his idea of, like, what other people must be thinking or what they should be thinking if that's what their priority is. Like, so his attitude is, if you want to win the game, if you're playing to win, then you need to keep the strong players around so that you can get to the point later in the game where you can start taking them out. Whereas for other people, their attitude is, we have to take out the strong players now because otherwise we might not get a chance to, and they can come after us and use their strength to take us out. So he's kind of locked into this one view of the game, which a lot of people don't agree with him on, and which, if you don't agree with him, you're obviously going to act very differently. And so that's maybe a kind of failure of empathy almost, or I don't know.
Well, I think with the very notable exceptions of Sandra and Aubrey, who both obviously had enormous reputations, I think Aubrey not comparable with Sandra, but immediately on the heels of Ko Rong, I think was probably the peak of her reputation too. They've been going to all of these votes and not been getting voted out, even as probably these much bigger priority figures within the game. But it has definitely been the trend this season, Dom, that the big names and big reputations and big targets are the people who are falling early. And I think JT was just completely misguided in thinking that everyone on, even when it's an all-star season, even when it's a season called Game Changers, I would say there is probably close to half the cast here who is not playing the way JT would probably be imagining that they would play. And that's a huge issue. Like, all that matters when you're thinking in terms of what other people are doing or what their priorities would be is making sure you have an accurate idea of how, of the way that they would actually think through that decision.
Yeah, exactly. So let's go back to the events of last week, because I think you need to understand those to give the context for this episode. And it was kind of impossible to understand those last week. And we noted that Rob and Steven at the Live Know-It-Alls seemed to have unavoidably were having trouble just even dissecting it, because how do you even make sense of that based on the edited 5 minutes that we saw on screen? Now that we've had some time to digest that, and we've seen the aftermath of that with JT getting voted out, and we've also got to hear from JT about what his whole thought process was, we can make a bit more sense of that now. So he was saying that he was worried that that Brad and company would not vote for Sandra and that he would be exposed. And so, like, he would cast this dummy vote for Sandra, they would vote for their real target, and then someone else would go home, JT would be out there as having voted for Sandra, and now coming into this vote, he would still be on this tribe with Sandra, who would now try to vote him out. I think the issue there is, like, so Brad's tribe knows that with the new tiebreaker rule, if they, like, deliberately misdirect JT's vote and make it 5-5-1, they're drawing rocks, because no one's going to agree unanimously on who gets to go home. So they're not going to put themselves out there like that. And they actively want to avoid that scenario. So if they suspect that JT is casting this hinky vote, they need to make sure that he's on board with them as opposed to with the other team. So JT, like, has to commit, basically. JT has to take a side. And it felt like JT was trying to avoid doing that as much as he could.
Agree with that. It seemed like he was really trying to get away with having both sides think he was totally with them.
Right. And he was saying that Malcolm, like, he couldn't get Malcolm on board with just flipping outright to vote for Sandra. He didn't want to make that move yet. And obviously it's hard to coordinate that right there at Tribal Council when you don't know what the deal is. So it seemed like JT's idea was, okay, we're going to vote for Sierra. We're going to tell Brad that his entire group should vote for Sandra. And then either Sierra goes home, we take out someone from the other team, and I'm still in good standing with my tribe, or, like, if they do have an idol or if someone does flip, then Sandra goes home and I've taken out the biggest threat in the game and also the biggest threat to me, and I don't have any blood on my hands coming back to my own tribe. So if you put it in those terms, you can kind of see what JT was going for, but I don't know why he expected that to work. Because I think, like, when JT is the one who kicks all of this off by standing up at Tribal, going to talk to Brad, and then somehow magically Ty knows who to use the idol on and Sandra goes home, everyone, they're not stupid, right? They know what JT is going for there, because they've seen him pull the exact same move before with Tom and Colby to vet out Suri.
Right, but I mean, I think I almost made half of this point earlier when I was talking about how if that does go well and Sandra leaves, he then has majority there. And I think furthermore, we are then talking about what a great move that is by JT to tell them and make sure they get the vote, or, you know, they play the idol on the right person, knowing, of course, that his old pal Brad is going to take out Sandra. Maybe we are just being foolish for thinking that, hey, the Suri boot was the one fluke that worked out his way, and he was just being an idiot then too.
Well, so my takeaway from what JT said, and I could be wrong on this, was he didn't think that they had an idol. He just wanted to get their side's votes onto Sandra. And so I didn't know where he expected the sixth Sandra vote to come from if it wasn't going to be him. Like, if he wasn't going to make the move.
Isn't that still kind of win-win? If even, like, I don't think there's any consideration. Did he say he ever even considered putting his vote anywhere? Didn't you say he quickly ruled out putting his vote anywhere else other than with his team?
I think so. The thing is, though, so, okay, JT goes over. He tells Brad's side to vote for Sandra. So now Brad feels like JT hasn't made this full commitment to him because, okay, great, we put our five votes on Sandra. JT was still the sixth vote for the other side, voting out one of our team members. So all JT has done is get our hopes up, misdirect our votes, and JT is just kind of playing with us. And now JT has to go back to a tribe which saw JT go over to Brad, and then the only thing they saw then is Brad's entire tribe voted for Sandra. So what is Sandra going to make of that in reality?
Well, I mean, I think it's tricky here, and that's why it's such a gross spot to be. Like, yes, it's great because the votes are never coming on you in that spot if you're JT. But I think if you want to keep both sides happy, with you, which you definitely do, is, first of all, and is, as we flagged up many times last week and already a couple times now, is you cannot consider not voting with the people that you're going to go back to camp with and play ostensibly at least the next round or two with, if not all the way to the merge. I think you have to stay loyal to them. And I also think
So the whole point of this move, I think, is let's say you take out Sandra. So now you're on a five-person tribe. You have Malcolm and Aubrey, who you think are loyal to you, and that's all you need. You're done.
But I'm saying if you don't think there's an idol, like you have to – obviously, if you think there's an idol, like that's what you're playing into by telling them it's Sierra and trying to get their votes on Sandra. That is the best-case scenario. But even if you don't think there's an idol, there's no consideration, I don't think, in not doing that unless you're certain going into it. That you have Malcolm and Aubrey and anyone else on your side, but I think that is absolutely impossible when you know there are five votes you can't really fully account for that are going to be totally live entering that tribal council.
But my question with that is, like, if you don't have Malcolm and Aubrey, what is your long-term future on that tribe? Because, like, you can't rely on Sandra being willing to just keep you around and take you under her wing, and, like, is that really what you're going to put your entire game in?
I don't know, but I think there are better ways, like much cleaner ways than a tribal council with five unknown votes coming in that you can't even talk to before you get there to turn things on Sandra. Like, I think you have a much easier time. Say they just win that challenge and it's green and red who go to that vote, and now blue team loses this next one and the six of them go in the spot where JT just got voted out. I think even with or without an idol, I think he has a much easier time getting the tables turned on Sandra there than he does at this big group vote where they can't talk to five of the people that are going to be voting.
Well, so the issue there is, like, if it's a full six-person tribe, you know that Sandra, Varna, and Michaela are together, or at least maybe you should know, and then you need Malcolm to be on board with making it 3v3 somehow, or, like, because at this point JT doesn't have the idol, he doesn't know that he's going to have this tool that he can use to break that tie. So what is he really expecting to happen?
I mean, if you and Malcolm and Aubrey go to Jeff Varner and say, we are absolutely steadfast in voting out Sandra, where you will be one of the people 100% of the time drawing a rock, I think that is okay. A pretty compelling pitch.
And that could work, actually. Yeah, I hadn't considered that.
Yeah. And then the other thing is, the reason that it's so bad when to try to turn on Sandra outright and get Malcolm and Aubrey to flip is, how can you possibly guarantee that's not a pitch anyone is remotely willing to accept when there are five people from the other team going to that vote that are probably voting five strong. And what do we want to see happen? A 5-4-2 vote where they take out one of us because we were so set on blindsiding Sandra with our own votes?
Well, it just occurred to me, actually, that so if Brad's team goes in voting for Malcolm, JT can force them to switch to Sandra. Because if, as I said with the 5-5-1 thing earlier, like, if JT basically says, okay, my vote is on Sandra, then Brad's team knows it's going to be 5-5-1 unless we break up our votes, in which case their five votes just vote out one of us instead. So the only way to avoid that scenario for us is to put our five votes on Sandra, which I imagine they would all be happy with. Like,
right.
Even Haley, let's say, who has this connection with Sandra, is she going to want to draw rocks instead of voting her out? Probably not, right? So,
I was going to bring this up earlier, and then we got sidetracked. But this is what I was saying. Part one was, you cannot consider not voting with your group, and that leads to part two of, I would not at all be comfortable telling Brad Culpepper my vote will be on Sandra when I know I cannot follow through on that. Then I have just burned that entire side.
That, And that's the thing. I think you either have to commit fully and make the move and you say, okay, you guys vote for Sandra because I am also voting for Sandra and that's what we're doing. Or you don't try and do anything funny. You stick with your group. You don't give anything away and you just go six strong. You can't split the difference like JT did and expect it to work out cleanly.
Right. That's what my largest point was. Number one, I am definitely voting with my group of six and not trying to get cute on Sandra here with our own votes. Number two, that means I cannot lie to the other side and tell them that my vote is going somewhere else. Those are not five bridges I'm willing to burn this early.
Yeah. But so in a world where JT's pitch to his team is, I am so strong with Brad and the other group that when we get to the merge, I can hook us all up. If that's true, then surely his working relationship with Brad is good enough that he can just switch that vote to Sandra, get her out now, make the big move, guarantee his safety on his own tribe, get this thing together with Malcolm Norbury, and then also have this Brad connection to go back to later.
Well, I think I would imagine at least that the red team, as optimistic as they were that JT might flip over with them, I can't imagine they really thought he was going to. And it seemed to me like they saw right through what he was doing. Like, even whether he knew they had the idol or not, he was being honest about, hey, if you have an idol, give it to her so that you can take out Sandra for me. And I think they were very, you know, they were not going to tell him this, but I think it was probably a fine decision in their spot to say, well, as much as JT would love for us to take out Sandra, it seems like Malcolm right. is a much bigger priority there. And to go back to it, we saw Brad when he was giving his voting confessional. It really sounded to me like he knew that person was about to leave. And he said, you're the best player out here. We have to take you out.
Right, and so, but the thing is, though, it's like JT is framing it as, you guys can do my dirty work for me, and you're going to be happy about that, right? Whereas I think if he doesn't tell them who his side is voting for, but he just goes to them and says, I'm voting out Sandra, then it feels like their hand is forced.
I mean, yes, it is, but again, like, I guess that means that if I was in their shoes, I would think he couldn't be lying to me because he would never risk lying in that spot. Like, I would have to go for it. I totally see what you're saying, but I think once we get the reveal that he was lying to us, that's the end of the game for him, or at least for us.
Well, yeah, and that's, and obviously it's easier for us to think about this a week later in retrospect as opposed to in the 20 minutes at Tribal Council that JT has to even think about this. But it just feels to me like his actions weren't consistent with any one plan. Like, if you want to stick with your group and be invested in your group and hope that that's going to take you somewhere, then great, do that. If you want to make the big play and flip over and continue this legacy that you started in Heroes vs. Villains, then do that and make the best of it. But it feels like he just took this middle course that was never really going anywhere.
Yeah. No half measures, baby. That's Mike Ehrmantraut taught us all.
Yeah. So Adam Klein actually had a good tweet about this. So he said his take was, quote, I hate to see people saying that JT tarnished his legacy. Not at all. He submitted himself as one of the most entertaining risk takers ever. His moves here, successful or not, don't take away from his incredible game in Token Genes. Sometimes you swing and miss, but you always swing. And then he follows up in a reply by saying that not playing the idol was some ballsy move. And it's always like a leap of faith to not play it when you could be in danger. And I think the sentiment there is good. I want winners like Adam himself, hopefully one day, to be able to come back and play the game they want to play, make the moves they want to make, not fearing that if it goes wrong, or if they go out pre-merge or whatever, that the whole peanut gallery isn't going to come chime in and saying, oh, well, their win was a fluke and they were overrated the whole time, and this is further evidence for that. But I don't know that JT is actually the best example of what he's saying, because to me, the reason he failed the season was because he didn't take risks and he didn't make the big moves and he didn't swing. Like, I don't think he swung and missed. I think he just didn't swing, and that was the issue.
I mean, I think it's hard to say that, like, to say that telling the other tribe that the votes were going on Sierra was him not swinging. Like, I think that was him playing for the highest upside scenario of they hopefully have an idol and put their votes on Sandra and I get exactly what I want. Like, to me, that is always what I see when JT is making these kind of moves, is he is playing for the moonshot, as I described it earlier. He wants the huge increase in equity.
But that's what I'm saying. I think you get that so much more cleanly by actually just making the move yourself and taking that into your hands. And it's ironic to me that, like, JT's diagnosis of Malcolm going out was like Malcolm should have made the move to kind of take matters into his own hands, when it felt like to me JT's big lapse was not doing that himself. Like, he didn't take the move into his own hands.
Well,
he tried to, like, make Brad do it for him in this very indirect way. And so Brad just didn't do that, and then everything came crashing down.
I mean, it really sounds to me like you are mad at JT for not going rogue at that 6-on-5 tribal council. Like, you think you should have publicly said, hey, I'm going for Sandra, everyone hop on board.
Well, not publicly, but I think he could have gone to Brad and said, like, look, I'm ready for Sandra. This is how this has to work, and just, like, laid out the logic and then let the chips fall where they may. But if he had said, okay, I've decided the best thing to do is stay with my group, 6 strong, where it's going to be all, you know, all Nuku all the time, that's fine. And I would have respected that. But it felt like JT didn't know what he was going for. And, like, this is not – because it's like, if JT had a plan and the plan didn't work, then you could say, okay, well, I disagree with the plan, but you can see what he was going for, and that's fine. And that's, you know, maybe it made sense to him because of stuff that we didn't know about. I don't know what information would have to be missing for what JT did to make sense, if that makes sense.
I mean, I definitely hear what you're saying about it. Definitely seems at best inconsistent, like he's playing by ear and switching it up midway through. But I think that's exactly what he's doing. I think he is, like, he's just constantly trying to find whatever the angle is that's going to help him the most. And Survivor, hey man, that's a crazy game, and sometimes you have to just bail halfway through and go with a new idea.
Well, yeah, it's just like, think how many times we've spoken to someone and we've questioned them about a move which, when we were talking about the season, we thought seemed like a bad idea, and they've given us, like, the crucial piece of missing information that when you add that in, mm-hmm. oh, suddenly it all makes sense now, at least from their perspective. Like, if we got a chance to talk to JT about what he was thinking, and, like, we've got the exit interviews and so on, I don't know what JT would have to say for all of this to kind of fit together perfectly. Like, I don't know what the missing ingredient would be.
I mean, I really feel like it probably came down to JT overestimating just how much people wanted to keep him around. Like, I know that sounds like the obvious thing to say, but I think he thought that because he was so good in the challenges and such a provider, that they would have a really hard time being willing to pull the trigger on him when it really seems like they were looking for a reason.
Yeah, but either way, so Sugar got his revenge on JT in the end. Yes. Let's move on to, so we're saying this is a bad move for JT. Lots of people are saying this is a fantastic move for Sandra. So let's talk about her quickly. Well, not quickly, but let's talk about her in any case. So we've both been saying that Sandra, so far through 4 episodes, 5 episodes, whatever you want to call it, is playing a much more impressive game this time round, regardless of what the final outcome is, than she did in either of her winning games the first 2 times, which, if you're not someone who thinks about it the same way we do, it's just like a nonsensical, crazy argument. But I completely stand by it. I think that she, like, the skills that she is displaying here, and again, maybe this is all for naught. Maybe it's there's another swap next week and Sandra gets screwed over the same way that JT defenders would argue that he did, and Sandra just gets voted out. But regardless of what happens next, I think the skills that she's displayed so far and the way she's been able to follow through on these plans that she's come up with, it has really been impressing me. And let's get into why we're coming around, why we're having this Damascene conversion to the cause of Sandra.
Well, I mean, I can tell you exactly why it is for me. And, like, I totally understand that when people hear us say Sandra's done more in this one episode to impress us than she did in her first 2 seasons combined, that to them, that we sound like absolute lunatics. Like, we can't possibly know what we're talking about, but I totally stand by it. And the reason is we are finally seeing her, as I brought up earlier, like, actively trying to jockey for a good position in the game. Like, the way that I have always viewed Sandra is, on one of the end of the spectrum, we have Boston Rob, who I have constantly talked about the Boston Rob fallacy, and he is way too overbearing within the game Survivor, and, like, he bonds with people too closely and burns them too hard, and you should not at all want to control every single boot, and you should not at all always want to vote out whoever the biggest threat is. Like, that is a fundamentally flawed way of looking at the game. Simultaneously, on the other end of the spectrum, you had Sandra and her anybody but me, which she really seemed to practice what she preached the first time. Like, it really seemed like, with the exception of the coach boot, she really never gave a fuck at all who ended up leaving at any tribal council. Oftentimes she acted like her own vote didn't even matter in some situations, and I really felt like it was almost entirely because of luck and circumstance that she got to the results that she got to. But now we are seeing Sandra actively try to think about her spot in game terms and what actually makes sense for her, and care about who ends up leaving and actively pursue seeing them leave.
So to me, it was almost from the opposite standpoint of, she was trying, like, she wasn't actually living by this anyone but me philosophy. She did get who went home, but she just wasn't able to exert any control over that. So like we saw, I think, in Pearl Islands, like, Fairplay was saying at the Tawana vote, when he and Burden should have been the obvious targets there. It should have been the former Drake people, the former Morgan people banding together to vote out the obvious threesome that was running the game. Instead, like, he was able to set off this feud between Sandra and Tawana, and like get Sandra to go on this tirade against Tawana, and like this vendetta to get her voted out. And that's not anyone but me. That is specifically Tawana. I want her gone, and I'm gonna sabotage my own chances of winning the game in order to make that happen.
Right. And quickly, I know that Johnny Fairplay is not nearly the most sympathetic figure out so I don't ever publicly make this point, but I swear to you, up until this season, when people would list like Sandra's greatest moves, and I think her best move was the Tawana boot. Like, she got owned into booting Tawana. Like, she got manipulated into booting Tawana. Like, that is not something that's not a point in her favor, let alone the best thing she's ever done. There's nothing else you can point to other than the coach boot. That's the only time she's ever seen even caring.
Or when she spends 38 days trying and failing to get out Russell, even though Russell being in the game is one of the best things for her, arguably. Like, that's not anyone but me. That is, I want Russell gone, right? And it's her not being able to make that work. Here, it's I want JT gone, and it's I'm going to do everything I can and do it very skillfully, as it turns out, to get JT gone, and it works. And that's why we're coming around now, because this isn't like a fundamentally new thing that we're seeing from Sandra in that sense. Is the same kind of thing that she tried to do before, but it's actually working this time, and it's working in her favor.
Right. I described her first two seasons as she spent 38 days wanting Johnny Fairplay gone and 39 days wanting Russell gone, or I guess 37 and 38 respectively. But like, the analogy I've made is she spends the whole game trying to shoot herself in the foot, but her aim is so bad that she keeps missing, and everyone else is looking around going, why would we take out the person trying to shoot herself in the foot constantly?
Right, whereas this time it is unique in the sense that she is at the top of the alliance, she's making these decisions, and when she's in that role, she seems to have adjusted to it almost perfectly. Like, she is playing the kind of game that you would associate with someone like, maybe not Boston Rob, but like someone in that mold who is running everything top down. Like, she is giving the orders, and it's almost like she is better at that than she is at the game that people keep crediting her for having like invented and mastered.
Well, I think a big piece in, you know, what people always used to say is Sandra can't go in there and play like Boston Rob. I think we see that she absolutely can when she is viewed in the same way that Boston Rob is viewed. And like, these are a group of quite, you know, in a lot of their cases, pretty generously labeled all-stars looking up to this two-time winner. Like, she is the big authority figure this time around. Even her last time as a former winner, she was half the cast didn't know who she was.
Yeah, so that's a very long rationalization for why we are now the number one Sandra Diaz-Twine fans on the internet, and we're never going to let anyone take that away from us.
No, I think we've been consistent about that. We've been big-time Sandra believers throughout. But, like, I really do want to conclude this by saying I am so, so happy, like, that we are able to be giving her credit for stuff. And, like, I genuinely am totally impressed with a lot of the stuff that she's been doing this season. And this is such a preferable timeline for me than spending another season, just not another, but a full season or however many episodes she's in, just trashing Sandra week after week. I really hope we get to see more of Sandra actively pursuing things that are in her own best interest, because I would love nothing more than to bridge the gap and to come together with all of the Sandra Yas Queen slay fangirls.
Right, and conversely to my bad feeling about JT, I had a good feeling about Sandra, and I feel like those are the only two things I'm going to be validated on this season. And like I was saying, I want, give me reasons to believe. I want to believe. I want to buy in. I want to be in on the joke. And it feels like we're finally bridging that gap, as you say.
All right.
So let's talk about someone else who I think has also been very impressive this season, but much more quietly, and that's Jeff Varner, who was criticized coming out of Cambodia for playing like too hard, too fast, and making fantastic television in the process. And that's, I think, what earned him his time playing this time round. But it feels like he is doing exactly what he should be doing, and exactly what he failed to do the second time round, which is just sit back, let the game come to him, and figure it out from there. And it seems like he's doing that perfectly so far.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I think it's also a much better cast for Jeff Varner, having a lot of like all-star historic titans out there versus everyone is out there for exactly their second chance, and none of them are former winners. And he's probably, you know, there are some people who are much worse at the challenges this season, I think, than there were on second chance, where that's not as big of an issue for him. But I think you're spot on in Jeff Varner. I think got the nerves out of his system. He got his feet wet again after 15 years, and now he is really letting the game come to him. And I think a lot of that has been circumstance. votes, but he has definitely survived a lot of votes here. Has he misvoted yet? It seems like he's been in the know on all of them, and it really seems like even entering this swap, he's on good terms with pretty much everyone he's ever worked with, and it seems like there's no reason to really feel like anything's going to be turning around on Jeff Varner anytime soon, as far as I can tell. I really don't think he's going to be viewed as too much of a threat.
Yeah, and even though he does seem to be this loyal Sandra partisan at this point, it's hard to see how there could be a swap that would be that bad for him. Like, maybe he is the one person from either of his former tribes against, like, in the kind of JT or Troizan position. But otherwise, like, who is coming to this stage of the game thinking, I really have to gun for Jeff Varner? Like, he's the guy at the top of my hit list. Like, no one is really scared of him, and yet he's the one person who I think could just, like, slip and slide and go wherever he needs to.
I mean, if we want to look super long-term for Jeff Varner, assuming he is able to get through these next couple of rounds and just kind of hang out, and if he goes to a vote, so be it, just relax and vote with whoever everyone is, you know, coming up to you and telling you to vote for, because it seems like the target's not going to be him. Once he hits that merge, I think he could very quickly be vaulting up the last longer equity of, like, who's targeting Jeff Varner once they hit the merge, unless he is so actively sketchy that they feel they have to, which is very much in the realm of possibility, but at least Jeff Varner 3.0 seems to be chilling out a little bit.
So here's a thought for you. Coming hot on the heels of your "what about JT as a losing finalist" theory from last week, here comes "what about Jeff Varner as a losing finalist?"
I buy it. I totally buy it. I could even buy Jeff Varner as a possible winner, although I will go back to the very premiere, and this is why I went into it in such detail, yeah. Is in the premiere, 18 out of 20 people got introduced to the audience before the immunity challenge. The two who didn't were Aubrey and Jeff Varner, and I think that is definitely going to stay with me.
And Jeff's introduction at that immunity challenge was just, like, pathetically right. Crawling over the – yeah. So not the best start for him. But I can definitely see him as someone who is going to be there, like, long-term as a relevant player, and – I could see him as a losing finalist, certainly.
Yeah, I would say the only people that would be in the conversation for me, if I were to do a last longer bet, just they don't have to win, just whoever's in there the longest, would certainly be Michaela, Brad Culpepper, and probably Haley Ford would be the only people I might pick before Jeff Varner at this point. Ty, actually, I think Ty is an interesting pick for a last longer too.
Yeah, but Varner, certainly someone who I think his stock is rising. Someone whose stock is falling maybe is your girl Michaela. So I'll let you take the floor on her quickly.
Well, this was the thing is, for this episode, as soon as it became clear that JT and Michaela were the two possible boots here, this was easily the least suspenseful, like, 10 minutes of the season for me, because we've hashed out many times, like, I feel like there is almost no way that Michaela is not in there, probably to the finale, just because of how eager it seemed like Jeff Probst was to get her back on camera at the season 33 reunion, and then his question to her at the reunion was, "Hey, Michaela, do you feel like you had to get voted out once to realize how good of a player you are at this game?" Jeff, as I've mentioned earlier in this podcast, not the most subtle guy out there. I would still definitely think Michaela is a long-term player for sure, but I how about Michaela as a losing finalist? I think that is very well within the realm of possibility.
Yeah, not much so far to make us realize why Michaela is so good at the game. So more to come on that front, hopefully.
Right. Well, hey, Dom, how about this? How about Sandra over Jeff Varner and Michaela in the finals? And this is exactly, wow. We just saw the preview right here.
That's scarily realistic, actually. I mean, we spoke about it in the past. We think Sandra, with the whole goat thing, maybe. But then, like, it's Sandra, right? So is that even disqualifying somehow?
Well,
like,
that's I actually...
We've seen worse.
Right, I brought this up to you off-air and forgot to bring it up on-air, but think about how that scene with the goats now reads, now that Malcolm and JT are the next two out. Like, to me, that was unambiguous. Sandra is a bad person for wanting to kill these poor little goats.
Or maybe it's Malcolm and JT are too tender and soft-hearted, and in Survivor Game Changers, you need to go in there and be hardcore and cutthroat and bloodthirsty, and Sandra perfectly epitomizes that. So.
I guess so, man. Are you going to suddenly come around? Hey, how about this? If Sandra wins this season, you have to stop being a vegetarian. You have to start eating meat. I think that's what we have to put on the line here.
If Sandra wins a season, I'm going, like, full, like, level 7 vegan. I'm never going within a 200-meter radius of another animal.
You're going, like, macrobiotic, where everything's weighed out for you.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I don't think Sandra's going to win. I think she's going to be cut down at some point. But I think she's going to have a longer run than even her diehard fans expected her to, and I think I'm going to be surprisingly happy that that's the case.
Yeah, I totally agree with all of that. Like, I genuinely, like, I have never been lying when I say that Sandra is an A++ historically elite character. I love...
That's the thing. I don't even like her as a character, and yet here I am, you know, expecting and wanting her to go far in the season.
See, I love this kind of stuff, like her making, you know, like winking at the camera, like making these goofy faces to the camera. Like, I love having Sandra, and her confessionals are hilarious. Good. I like she has never been someone to shy away from stirring up drama at the camp, but because of that, like, I'm also going to take away some points as a player when she yells at people all the time. Like, that's not great.
Speaking of characters, did you like Michaela's whole theatrics at Tribal Council with the tea set and the props and everything?
I liked it once. I don't know if I'm going to keep liking it if this continues with Michaela or just in general. I think that's potentially a Pandora's box I don't want to open. Having everyone bring all these props to Tribal Councils. I know I famously railed against being Mark the Chicken being allowed at Final Tribal Council. I thought that was an unfair advantage for Ty. I don't know. I think it's fun once. That's what I'm going to say for now. And we'll see how this progresses.
Yeah, leave the bag of tricks back at camp, I think.
Right.
The crazy thing with Mark the Chicken is, like, how did they get him to Tribal Council? Because, like, was he just, like, sitting on Ty's... in the van with everyone thinking, what the fuck is going on?
It sounds like, I mean, it seems like within a matter of days, they have all the chickens trained to not leave, or it seemed like Mark the Chicken was just following Ty around all the time. I'm sure their relationship was at the point where they could, you know, he could just carry him around wherever he wanted to. I'm sure they had some trust formed over there. That was the tightest alliance in Ko-Rong by a mile, was Ty and Mark the Chicken.
Yeah. Going back to Michaela, though, it really felt like this was meant to be like a jiffable moment, right? Like, she knew, okay, when this episode airs, this is going to be the big thing that everyone on Twitter is talking about. So I'm going to put myself in there, which I credit from a branding perspective, I suppose. But I really hope this doesn't become a consistent trend.
Yeah, we'll see. I definitely did enjoy it in the moment. I was like, okay, that's hysterical. But I could, you know, upon having some time for further reflection, I don't want the floodgates to open here necessarily.
Yeah, she's spilling the tea. You see, it's hilarious. Let's put a limit on that.
Yeah.
What else do we even have to get to from this
one
week?
Thing I just wanted to bring up quickly, because I got a question about this on Twitter from Vince Floyd. It's about Aubrey and about just how little we've seen of her. But if we think back to the Heroes versus Villains season, Dom, that was where Sandra, our eventual winner, went 6 consecutive episodes without a confessional. Aubrey has certainly gotten more than that. She's been on the show for sure. She had a great line this episode saying, the Fijian gods are not loving Nuka right now. Nuku, I don't even know the name of it. That's the point we're at. I think she's in there handing out some hysterical wry commentary once or twice per episode. But do you think it's possible, as Vince Floyd does, that perhaps they are hiding her because it's not until some fortuitous swap draws or whatever that things start actually going her way and she's going to be one of the easier people to remember? Are there longer term legs here for Aubrey?
Well, thank you for the question, Vince. I think the answer is no. Okay, next question. What have we got?
Follow-up question to that, because this is Vince's alternate theory, which I really liked until I had someone else tweet it at me, and now I feel like people are just spoiled. I don't think anything like this would even be out there. From what I've been told, only pre-merge spoilers exist and are confirmed. So that's very good to hear. I certainly don't know any spoilers myself. But something that has been mentioned to me multiple times is, what if Aubrey is a Rockdraw victim, and that is why she is so under-edited? You know, we have this twist where Rockdraws are a lot easier to come by.
And also, when the Rockdraw or the new tiebreaker rules are announced, and the first thing we see is Aubrey with these, like, contorting facial expressions, like, trying to make sense of everything.
That's a good theory. I hadn't thought about that part.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Vince, why would you even bring this into the universe, okay? Why would you do this to me?
Yeah. All right, I don't know. I don't think winner is in play. I definitely do think Rockdraw is in play.
Yeah, it's depressing, though, because as hashtag Team Aubrey members, and you're wearing the shirt as we speak, no one can see it, okay? This is not a visual medium.
I just held my shirt up as if there was, like, a live streaming audience.
Yeah, as fully paid-up members of Team Aubrey, and we have to give the commercials every single episode, it is depressing that she is the person who we're talking about as, like, where is Aubrey this week? Like, she is the purple, like, person member that we... Yeah, it's really not a good sign.
Well, I mean, I think she is at least in there much more so than, for instance, like, Andrea Belki has been virtually nowhere to be seen. Yeah,
that's a high bar to clear this season. Yeah, just because of Andrea.
Yeah. Who... Yeah, I don't know. I think Aubrey could definitely be in there for many, many more episodes, but I would be pretty surprised if she was like a major winner candidate. But again, like, stranger things have certainly happened on All-Star season, so definitely still a lot up in the air there. Dom, as we have mentioned, next time we are going to be swapping tribes again, so that could be pretty exciting. And also, some mystery former survivor is going to come back in and make a surprise appearance on the show. It sounds like they are going to probably help out with whoever gets sent to Exile Island or something along those lines. Who you got? Who's this going to be?
So I was thinking Boston Rob maybe, but then he had that April Fool's Day tweet about being that person, and I don't think that kind of like double bluff or whatever is within his range. So I'm counting on Boston Rob. It's got to be Rupert, right? Like, it can't not be Rupert.
I was thinking about it, and I tweeted this out, is realistically, how is it anyone other than Rupert? Like, it seems like it's got to be someone recognizable. And the only other person that people continued to tweet at me was Terry Dietz, who makes sense with, you know, having things go down the way they did for him right around this time in the game on his second chance, and also having such a strong connection to Exile Island itself and presumably being a big resource out there. I think that would make sense. My question is, I don't think Terry is remotely recognizable to the average casual viewer. So I go back to, how is it not Rupert? It seems like it has to be Rupert.
I think Terry was recognizable enough to the average casual viewer that he was voted back onto Second Chances. And I don't think it was like the RHAP hardcore fan base who was getting Terry back on there. So I don't know. I think he still has some connection for people. The thing with Rupert, though, is there is zero chance that if it was Rupert, he wouldn't be in his tie-dye costume. And if you look at the boat when the person's coming in, there's no like lurid glimpse of tie-dye there. So I, yeah, it feels like it's got to be... What?
Can you see any? Is there a little bee hat, or is there? What's going on? What can you see?
It's like one of those like mystery avatars that you see or something. No, you really couldn't see anything, but it feels like it's got to be someone more conventional. But I don't even know who's in the picture.
I really hope it's Tony. I hope they just put Tony back out there for some reason.
Like Tony's officially re-entering the game.
Right. Like, yeah, you get sent to exile and you just have 24 hours of listening to Tony complain about how screwed he got or whatever. Not that it seems genuine to go back to it. So there's no confusion. Tony seems to have taken it extraordinarily well still to like all, everything. It seems like Tony's taken well.
Sure, yeah. But I would love it if it's like you go to Exile and then you have to swap with Tony, and then Tony just comes back to the camp and starts.
They think, yeah, like Ozzy gets sent to Exile Island and they all make their vote out thinking they're going to get Ozzy back, but Tony beats him in some challenge on it, so Tony is the one who re-enters the game or whatever. I think that's definitely, I think that's what we're looking at. I think that's what we're going to see next week.
And you see all the people who are spoiled but very badly trying to hide it, saying, I think Tony's going to make it to the final three. And, you know, it's like no joke. In Pearl Island, there are literally people saying on public forums, I think Lil is going to make it to the finals after Lil had already been voted out.
Right.
Like, this is literally a thing that happened.
Right,
people were so bad at disguising how spoiled they were, which if the spoilers out, as far as I know, the spoilers out there are fairly minimal this season, but I'm taking all the necessary precautions anyway, so hopefully we can avoid all of that for the rest of the season. But
yeah definitely. So Dom, I guess any other thoughts on the SWAT? I guess who's looking particularly good for you right now? I guess it's going to be tough to say without knowing how these tribe draws end up going down, but I would say, barring some disaster tribe draw with Debbie, I would still say Brad Culpepper probably has to be the number one candidate for me. I would also, I guess, say if I'm looking at winners, like Sierra and Haley would probably be up there. I think the only person I really have locked in for the finale is Michaela, and I really don't think she's going to win now.
So talking about final threes, like Brad, Sierra, and Haley is perfectly on the cards, right? Like that's a universe we could be living in 2 months from now.
No, I mean, I think it would be perfectly in line with how the beginning of this game is played out, is we lose the people like the poster child of big moves, Sierra, and then Tony and Malcolm and JT. We lose all of these giant heavy hitters early. Maybe a couple of them make it through to the mid game and one or two sneaks through to the end game. But I think it would be completely in line with how everything has played out so far if we were to end up seeing If we were to end up seeing something like Brad, Sierra, and Haley, literally that combination of three, that I would guess, if we were to just pull like Survivor Twitter or like air quotes super fans in general, probably the three most debatable casting choices of the season, I could easily see being the final three.
Yeah, and if that happens, the whole dictum that you always hear about how All-Star seasons are always won by the least worthy casting choice, whether you think that's like Amber or Parvati or like Mike Boogie, if you want to go cross franchise, like that's
how dare you.
Yeah, Big Brother superstar Mike Boogie, of course, my apologies. But like that theory would get the ultimate validation, right, if that ends up being the final three. Like,
yeah, I mean, it's the examples are so few and far between of people who previously had big reputations being even allowed to play in an All-Star season. They're just taken out. Like Sandra, I think, is probably the best example of someone being, you know, in control. And, you know, that's why Boston Rob, like, did not get it done on a returning shot against other All-Stars. It was against all new players who did not know better, I would say.
And Boston Rob, you could argue, was himself one of the least understandable casting choices for All-Stars, which he made it to the finals against Amber in. So
right, no, I mean, yeah, the original All-Star season, Boston Rob was for sure the last guy to get picked, and Amber was for sure the last girl to get picked, and they ended up running the entire season because everyone else just was worried about, you know, oh, my public perception, if I let Richard Hatch get further than me, if I'm that stupid to not vote him out first, like, how do I not do it for the lols?
So on that uplifting note, is there anything else you want to get to today?
No, I'm good. This ran quite a while, as it turns out.
It
but
did.
I think this turned out well. No, I think I'm all set. I guess follow me on Twitter @ColinStone. And I don't know if Dom has Twitter, so don't worry about that.
Oh, well, thank you. So follow me @DomHRV. Send us an email, domandcolin@gmail.com. And if you haven't already, and most of you haven't, you ungrateful swine, go and leave us a rating on iTunes, because we need to move up the charts. We're like, we need to be, I know what we're even at the moment, but we need to be higher than whatever we are. So
I won't rest until we're the number one Survivor podcast in England. I feel like at least we should be, actually, no, there's no chance. I mean, Rob has an international enough of it. There's absolutely no chance we could be the number one podcast in England.
I don't know if there are enough Survivor fans in England for that to even be a category on iTunes. Like, I don't think it's that granular.
Yeah. All right. No, I'm all set. So I guess, yeah, that's going to do it. Thank you guys very much for tuning in. We will definitely be back next week talking to you very soon. Take care, everybody. Your line, don't cross them lines. What you like, what I like, why can't we both be right? My time.